Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
The following is a production of the Emerson News Network.
I would have to say it's his anger. I mean, he goes from 0 to 100 in a second flat.
Come on.
Do you feel this is an accurate assessment?
No, I'm a very calm guy. I mean, whether it's I'm a very calm person, all right? Whether I'm at work or in a social situation, I am extremely calm. But my wife, who I love very dearly, she likes to nag, and I react to the nagging.
Overreact.
Sometimes, okay, maybe, but without the nagging, no reaction.
Well, what he calls nagging, I call trying to have a relationship.
Look, there's no proverbial judge sitting on a bench judging you.
Ari, I told you to turn that off.
I did turn it off, but this is the emergency line. This is the bat line, baby.
Do you need to get that?
I do need to take this,
no,
yes.
No, he doesn't. I ask for 1 hour out of a day for his undivided attention. And I can't even have that.
You can have it if you want to live in a girl's hills. And go to group therapy, but if you want a Beverly Hills mansion, and you want a country club membership, and you want 9 weeks a year at a Tuscan villa, then I'm going to need to take a call when it comes in at noon on a motherfucking Wednesday!
Hello, it is 27 minutes after the hour of 1, and this is the month of June in the year of our Lord, 2011. Thank you for drawing near, that ye might be amused and informed on this Wednesday. It is Wednesday, June 8th, 2011, and welcome to day 12. We are here, broadcasting from high atop the Milkpacking District in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon, the hallowed halls of the Emerson News Network, from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of SAME. My name is Rick Emerson, and good day to you. It's 503-505-6964. If you would like to engage with us telephonically today with your comments, questions, clarifications, observations, ruminations, ponderings, musings of an ironic nature, whatever it is you might have to share with your fellow man, your brethren, your sisterin on this day. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. I was going to make a joke about her shoe size, but I don't even know what that is. She's filling like the size 6 wedgies of...
I think she has small feet.
Small... She's a diminutive-footed person.
Yeah.
Filling in for Ms. Dawn Taylor is our good friend Eric D. Snyder. Hello, sir.
Hello! How are you?
I am fantabulous. It's almost as though we just didn't spend 90 minutes together in this room.
Almost as though that were the case.
So Dawn Taylor is absent today. She will be returning tomorrow, but Mr. Eric D. Snyder sat in for Legion of News and will be performing that self-same... role here.
It's too bad that we never see me and Dawn in the same place at the same time.
I think that I can count on only one finger the number of times that's ever happened. And really,
yeah.
I think then it was like you both weren't speaking at the same time.
Yeah.
It was like that thing of the guy throwing his voice while drinking a glass of water. It never happened.
Right.
One of you could just be some sort of a spinning image puppet of the other. You know what I mean? One of you could just be working, I was going to say working the other under the table, but that sounds like something else altogether.
That is also happening, but that's unrelated.
Hey now! All right, what was I just doing? Email. Yes, you could be emailed if people would like to do that. It's eric@ericdsnyder.com. Is it not?
It is that.
Fantastic.
And you always say that, and nobody has ever actually emailed me.
Really?
I hope that someone does, just to say hi. Not even once.
Never?
No one's ever had anything to say to me, I guess.
Yeah. All right, well, fair enough. Yeah. Maybe they just feel such a deep and abiding sense of sadness for you that you have to be incarcerated in this room with me. Maybe they're just so busy being ashamed for you and for all of us.
They could send condolences.
Sort of, sorry about the Rick. All right, sorry about the debasement of your journalistic abilities and talents.
Well,
yeah,
that ship is long since sailed.
Well, that wasn't me saying that just now. I'm not sorry about that anyway. I revel in the dilution of your academic training by its use on this show.
Do we all?
It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. You can also email it to rick@rickemerson.com or eric@ericdsnyder.com. Also, let's see, text box open on the website. And if you want to get at us via Skype, hit us up, as the kids say. It's Rick Emerson Show. It's all one word there, Rick Emerson Show. Be a Skype. I'm going to retire the phrase "as the kids say" from my vocabulary. I feel that's a thing that probably stopped being funny like 15 years ago.
It might. Yeah, you may be right about that.
I just don't think it's just become like this reflexive. I don't know, like a reflexively used arrow in my quiver that I probably should just abstain from that. Eschew that.
I use it too. I think you're probably right. It probably has gotten past the point of being used ironically, and now it's just
some crap that old people say.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't want to be that guy. Yeah. You know, because then you know what you're like. Then it's like you take one step further. You know, one step closer to not just being your dad, but to being like every like jackass old guy you ever worked with.
Right.
I was talking about this with somebody yesterday. It's like that guy we all work with that feels compelled, forced by some power greater than himself to, when he is leaving the office on New Year's Eve, to go, "See you next year." I hate that guy.
Right.
Or the guy who's always in line in front of me at the supermarket, who, like, when the scanner doesn't properly register the cost of his item, he goes, "Well, I guess it's free."
Yeah.
You know, you just want to go, like, shut it.
You working hard or hardly working?
I'm not drinking anymore or any less.
Ah.
Yeah. So there you go. Anyway. All right. Yeah. So.
It's fun hating everyone.
At the kids say that's as the kids say that's going to be gone. That's going right. to be as of. Now it's going to be put into deep storage in my brain.
All right.
Let's see. What are we? Somebody says, of all the piles of crap you always say, just to say it, that's the one thing you're going to get rid of.
Well, you have to start somewhere.
Whatever. That's what I'm saying. It's like you can't get to the. It's like on that show Hoarders. Mm-hmm. It's like you can't get to the back without getting rid of the sort of, you know, just the piles of Saran wrap that are wadded up front. You know, it's like every journey begins with a single step. You dick.
As the kids say.
Yeah. Exactly. See. I observed what was engaged in by you just then. I have a friend of mine. I went to my friend Mike Chase, who works at he works in the Mike and Amy show over at the Wolf. He has this whole thing where, I don't know if he still does this, but where he created these really, really, really long, like, verbose ways of saying "that's what she said" without actually saying "that's what she said." And, nice. You know, it was, in my last interaction with her, a sentiment was expressed that was virtually the same.
That's funny.
It is. It works on, and that works on several levels, especially if he's talking to somebody who doesn't really know what he's doing right there.
Right, so, right. That's fun.
And so there you go. So Don Snyder returns tomorrow, you know, or not?
You just called her Don Snyder.
Did I say Don Snyder?
You sure
see,
did.
Now it is. But now, because of what you said earlier, I've conflated the two of you into one person. Now you're like a Brundle Dawn. Yeah.
Yikes.
Pardon me. I thought your laugh was going to be longer there, and no. I was going to have a chance to take it. I thought you were going to find me even more hilarious, and right. your laugh would be of sufficient duration for me to take a drink of water, and that didn't really happen. You finished, you're like, ha-ha, and then there was just the sound of a over here on my side.
Sorry I don't find you as hilarious as you thought I would.
You think I'd be used to that by now?
Exactly.
You think I would learn to, if anything, just sort of underplan that sort of a thing?
Yeah.
It's going to be a great show. I could just sense it. I could feel it in my bones. It's going to be a great day. One of the best we've ever had. Amity, as you know, means friendship. All right. Coming up today, we've got your Snuff Watch, Taser Watch, Corpse Watch. Coming up today, also Ms. Anna Griffin from the Oregonian is going to be joining us at the Rick Emerson studio. She'll be here. She's going to be... So I think somebody said she's going to be leaving halfway through July. She's going to be leaving the second week of July. So she's here like every other week. So I guess we got her here today maybe once or twice more. But then she's going to be leaving to start her Nieman Fellowship at Harvard. So we're going to be talking to her today. Also, we got a top five. One of the first we've done in a while. We've sort of been slacking on the top five front. Today, top five songs. I've just spun the great and mighty wheel of chronology. And the finger of Kronos lands on December 8th, 1973. So we are going to, and I'm not going to give any hints. I'm not even going to tip my hand.
Yes, you tip your hand.
Tip the hand as to what it might be. So, to what sorts of songs might be contained in that list. But we're going to get to the top five later on today. The top five songs, December 8th, 1973. So let's see. Yes, Snuff Watch, Taser Watch, Corpse Watch, Anna Griffin, that top five coming up, and more. Plus Eric D. Snyder working on the following headlines for your edification on this Wednesday.
Hey, you know, Bob Barker, he's saying don't go to SeaWorld.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Another headline. There it is. A man is guilty in charges stemming from a poker bet over a bottle of urine. And the troops say that they were billed. Troops say that Delta Airline charged them for their baggage.
I'm back at the thing about a bet being over a bottle of urine.
Mm-hmm.
Was it just tell me just this much, unless you feel like the whole thing is worth just saving. Was the bottle of urine the prize? Was it like, and the winner gets, and then a guy just shakes a flask of yellow liquid and...
No.
Okay, all right.
It was the bet had to do with the existence of the bottle of urine.
All right, that also wasn't the way I would have thought. See, if you were to ask me just now, if you'd said, no, the bottle of urine wasn't the prize, the bottle of urine was, and asked me to fill in the blank, my second guess would have been?
Hmm.
Second guess would have been that somebody bet somebody else, presumably in a bar, undoubtedly after having many libations,
right,
that he could consume the entire bottle of urine.
Oh, I was going to say maybe, or that it would be a bet that he could fill a bottle with urine.
Hey.
Fill it to the top.
There you go.
Produce a bottle's worth of urine.
Something there. You know, my grandmother was a barmaid in Silverton, I guess, or maybe Markham.
Mm-hmm.
But there was this place called the My Place Tavern.
Sure.
And the front of it, the facade, looked a lot like a barn. And I seem to remember just being dropped off there for hours at a time when I was growing up. I don't know what that was all about. But my grandmother was a barmaid there. And just sort of a, you know, like when you think of, at least if you're me, and you think of barmaid, like you think like the hot chicks that work at my father's place on Grand. She wasn't really like that. She was sort of like Principal Skinner's mother.
Right.
But like in something that was inappropriately low cut, you know, and just so you could take in, just take in the wondrous, you know, topographical sight of every wrinkle.
Cloris Leachman.
Exactly. But not quite as sexy.
Right.
But she used to tell just the most horrific stories about guys who would make bar bets about what they could do or something that a guy could do for, you know, like 3 minutes without, you know, something else. And the worst, the one that stuck with me forever, and I won't go on and on about it, is just that she, because, I mean, really, what else needs to be said? Is just these two guys who were arguing, and, like, they decided that the only way that they could settle the disagreement was for, like, a gauntlet to be thrown down about whether guy number one could drink the contents of a spittoon.
Ugh.
That's what I'm saying.
That's terrible.
And it's like, why would you tell... First of all, why would that ever happen? Second of all, if you don't drink, that's why. Thirdly, if you were my grandmother, why would you then decide that that's something that I needed to hear about at the age of, like, five?
Well, make any sense, you could use it as an anecdote years later.
I guess. She knew what I did not know. She saw a future that was then hidden. From that revolting acorn, a mighty oak of comedy grew. All right, somebody wants to know if I can email Eric at ShowPony. No, there's nothing at ShowPony. It's ShowPony. You don't even know what we're talking about.
No.
Well, now I don't even know if I want to bring it up because it's like the explanation is just so much longer. So Dawn now has two email addresses. She has Dawn, D-A-W-N, at rickemerson.com, and she also has, it's all one word, she has ShowPony at rickemerson.com. Because Dawn's nickname, as given to her, I think, by the audience, is ShowPony.
Fair
sort
enough.
Of like, it's Rick and ShowPony in the morning.
Got it.
Because I believe that she said, we were talking about, I don't remember how, I was comparing myself to somebody and saying that I felt like just like an untalented hack compared to, you know, like probably anyone. And she was saying, it's like when I'm in the room with Storm Large. And she said, Storm, as you know, she's, you know, and Dawn was listing off this, you know,
right,
this whole, you know, this whole page full of attributes that Storm had. And Dawn said, you know, and then when I'm in the room, I just feel like a show pony.
Aww.
Not even a Lippin's Honor stallion, but a show pony.
Aww.
And so then somebody immediately latched onto, you know, Dawn Taylor, Dawn Show Pony Taylor, and then it was Show Pony and Rick, and then it was Show Pony in the morning.
I like it.
Anyway, and so now she has an email, a fully functional email address, by the way, which is showpony at rickemerson.com. Also, one of our friends is registered, one of our good friend Seamus is registered, rickandshowpony.com.
Nice.
Just in case we should ever decide to branch out and maybe become the morning show on that KBFF station that just went on.
Well, you know, it's good to have a fallback plan.
Well, it's, you know, as I say, one always has to be thinking about one's next job.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Anyway, so that is all coming up today. Snuffwatch, Taserwatch, Corpse Watch, Andrew Griffin, top five from December 8th, 1973, and so forth. By the way, if you find the comedic and conversational stylings of Mr. Eric D. Snyder to be amusing and you want to find out more about them, you can hear him Fridays 11 to noon at Movie BS with Baron Snyder at Cascadia.fm. You can also be read at EricDSnyder.com or at Film.com.
That's right.
Is it for Film.com and EricDSnyder.com that you write things upon your new standing desk?
It's
the
yes.
worst segue in the world. I know, I'm not going to pretend.
Funny you should ask, Rick.
It's amazing that I bring this up. I won't pretend that I hadn't heard about this before, but as we were getting ready to do the show, I said, well, you know, like, did you do anything interesting last night, thinking you might have gone to see a screening or there might have been something that, you know, something you did to fill the endless hours when you're not here enjoying the pleasure of my company.
Right.
And you said, well, I've got a new standing desk, which even as I say it out loud, note,
I realize it doesn't actually sort of play as interesting as it might have seemed in my head.
Well, that's what's interesting is how uninteresting it is. People say, "What have you been doing?" I say, "Well, I've been standing a lot."
Why would you own? Is it a desk that you modified to be like a stand-up desk?
Yes. Well, here's the thing. This is the new trend in workplace ergonomics. The New York Times has done stories about it, and it's the new thing where apparently sitting down all the time will kill you. Like just being sitting for 8 hours a day, as many people do.
Define will kill you.
Like it cuts like 6 years off your lifespan. Like there were infographics. I saw infographics, Rick.
Really?
Yes. Well, because it makes sense if you think about it. You're bad for your circulation. You don't. Your metabolism slows down. It's just not.
Was it showing two side by side things where there's like one guy standing and it's like he's just sort of it's like a red meat kind of a thing where it's just the same smiling face and then the other guy is just sort of he's just disintegrating into a pile of dust.
Basically, yes.
Okay. All right.
It's bad for your heart rate and your metabolism. You hardly burn any calories. I mean,
why would it be bad for your heart rate? That doesn't make any sense at all. It seems like
because you don't get any. It's the same as being lazy.
Not bad for. So I don't think it's the same as. I think it just is.
Well, yeah.
So it's not that it's bad for your heart. It's bad for. In other words, you're not getting any exercise.
It's bad for the standing.
You're not
strengthening your heart.
It contributes to a sedentary lifestyle.
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And of course, standing can have its own problems too. But it's generally speaking, if you do it right, healthier than sitting. And it makes sense. The human body wasn't meant to be, you know, folded at a 90-degree angle for 8 hours of the day. It's not what we're built for.
Now I just feel like my imminent doom is approaching, like, just while I sit here and listen
to
you.
That's how I felt. Someone sent me this thing, and I was, oh my gosh, now I'm afraid to ever sit down. So, but what people are doing now is they make desks that are higher up so that you are standing at your workplace instead of sitting to test it out rather than buy a new desk to experiment to see if it worked. I had a footstool that was the right height. Put it on my desk, my computer on top of that, and it's the perfect height. And I've been doing it for about almost 3 weeks now.
Now where is it now? So where you're typing? Where at what level do you put the keyboard?
Keyboard is still at the regular angle. What's that like a 90 degree angle?
But down
whatever?
At like slightly above waist level, like right below your ribs or something. Is that where your elbows are?
I guess yeah, about like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And they say that the. You do it, you want the top of your computer screen to be about level with the top of your head. That's
okay.
About what you want.
All right.
And, you know, adjust to whatever's comfortable. But I tried it, and at first I thought, well, I'm going to be tired. My legs are going to be sore. Like, I love sitting down. I don't know about you.
Well, you're an American. I mean, it
exactly.
Really is. That's the thing that we letter in that.
It's easy, and it's and it's fun.
And it's one step. You know
yes.
How to do it? You know.
I thought, this is going to be tough. But I tried it, and after the first couple of days, my legs and feet were sore. But after that, it's not even a thing anymore. It's not even a factor. I thought for sure it would take weeks to get used to it, and it would be arduous, like I'm a pioneer crossing the plains.
Americans are such horrible people.
I know, right. I have to stand.
I thought it was going to be tough. Well, having to stand like in your air-conditioned home while you type on a magic box from which you can order pizza.
I remember when I was a teenager, I worked one summer in retail, and I had to be like on my feet all the time, and it killed me. It was exhausting. And I know you get used to it, but if you're not used to it, you know, if you're not used to having to stand all the time.
There's some guy in Rwanda who's having to spend the whole day outrunning a guy with a chainsaw.
I know. Why? If they have chainsaws in Rwanda.
They had to step it up a little bit. They weren't getting enough done.
But it surprisingly has. I got used to it very quickly. And here's the unforeseen advantage. I am more focused and more energized and more efficient.
Well, you're not just sitting there just like a blob of shmoo-like substance.
It's so easy, especially if you're doing anything, quote-unquote, creatively. It's so easy to be sitting and to be kind of working but kind of not working. And then I'm writing. Oh, I got a little bit of a block. I'll surf the internet. It becomes very easy to just be lazy when you're sitting. When you're standing, you're oriented. You're goal oriented. You're doing something.
Now, when you work, do you have a schedule for writing? In other words, because like Stephen King has that whole thing about how he writes, like he does. I think it's 2,000 words a day, or which is like 10 pages, and he starts at like 7 a.m. and he goes to and he won't stop until his 2,000 words a day, you know, are done. And it's like we've introduced this guy, the leverage creator John Rogers told me, and this is a thing that I actually took from him. He works on the 48-12 system where he works for 48 minutes, and then takes a 12-minute break, which apparently Joe Esterhaas does as well. So it's like a 45-15 thing where he works for 40. And he's like, because otherwise, he's like, because if you prolong it too much, then it's like your brain wants to check email, your brain wants to watch TV, your brain wants to whatever. But you can't. You know, but you have to limit the amount of break time you give yourself. So it's like a 45-minute work cycle followed by a 15-minute break. So then being like a complete idiot, like I immediately like downloaded like a timer app, because of course I can't just use a clock, because you know what would be the point of that to configure my whole work routine.
I don't have anything quite that scheduled and rigorous, but I have noticed that standing up makes it a lot easier, especially if you're doing anything creative. To sort of brainstorm, I like to sort of walk around and pace and think out loud or whatever. And if you're already standing, it's more facilitated to that sort of energy, as opposed to now I got to stand up, now I got to come sit back down and get back. It's much more. It's a psychological thing, man.
Well, I know. Trust me, it's like I'm laughing a little bit, but I do know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I didn't even know if I was going to talk about this, but I because there's only one. It's not that interesting of a story because it's just. The story has like one stage of development, and then it never goes beyond that.
I bet that won't stop you from telling it.
No, probably it never does. But I went home last night at I don't know. I was here and I was working on some crap, and then I forget what I even did. I was here and then I had to go do something afterward. I don't know. It's escaping me. But anyway, so I get home last night, and the thing is, my wife is on this schedule right now. She's working like 2 to midnight. So the thing is, like, I'm left totally unattended. There's no adult supervision at my house at all. It's just me and the dogs.
Right.
And it's just like it just disaster looms constantly just around every corner. And but so when I get home, there's just sort of nobody there. So I went in and it's that thing of like where I fully intended to work. And I sat down in my chair in my office, which is where I do most of my work, most of my typing. And I sat down at like 7 o'clock. And by, I don't know, like 7:45, I realized I was still just sitting there and I actually hadn't moved at all. Like, I sat down with the, and I had the laptop with the little, like, sort of, you know, the little stand that goes across your knees and I get a side pad. But here's the other thing about it is, like, in my home office, like, I have a chair, but it's not a chair like, you know, like here where it's got the hard sort of seat or like a wooden chair.
Right.
It's like, I mean, it's like a big, it's basically like a huge, like, form-fitting
big comfy chair.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, and it's like
not conducive.
You get the big like ass groove in it after a while. It's like, you know, it really is just like some. It's like some. It's like some form fitting amorphous alien gelatinous goo chair of the future where you sit and it goes, and it just slowly envelops your form and you go, oh, right. It's so comfortable. It's like some Farscape chair or something, But the thing is, and it's really been fine for the most part, but within the last like 5 or 6 months, the structural integrity of the sort of ass place has started to break down.
Sure.
And so now when I sit in, it's like the whole chair really just absorbs me, and it becomes really, really big. And then it's like I'm in like a full napping position. It's like I'm in some sort of like a upholstered egg. And
especially if you're feeling at all slightly fatigued,
yeah.
You sit down like that, you're not going to get any work done.
Now, and I try. And here's the other thing. Well, I might as well just admit it all. So it's like this whole cascade of shame, where I don't eat a lot of fast food, like drive-through food. I typically avoid that, not because I'm like some health nut, but because there's a period of time a few years ago where I was getting real flabby, and I was getting like the big fat face and whatever. And one of the decisions I made, like I cut out soda, like carbonated, you know, like Coke or whatever. And then I cut out for the most part. You know, like fried, like McDonald's style food. You know,
right.
like your burger and fry style food, with rare exceptions. And again, I'm not like a Nazi about it, but I just, for the most part, I don't do that. But I was on the way home, and it's like this is where you realize what an idiot you are. By you, I mean me, where you like to think that you're. See, now it's all coming out. This is like when I go to the shrink, and and I tell the shrink says, "What's up this week?" And I go, "Oh, nothing much." And then it's like an hour later, I'm just there sobbing, admitting to kidnapping the Lindbergh child. It all comes out, I wasn't even going to tell this, but I'm driving home, and you like to think that you are so immune to advertising.
Sure.
You know, you like to think that I'm a savvy person. I know what they're up to. Look, friend, I work in the world of advertising and commerce. I work in communications. I know your little game. I'm on to you. And so you're not going to be taken in by just some sort of but then it's like I drive by that Wendy's that's on Powell's. And they just, first of all, I don't know how sea salt is different from like any other kind of salt. Salt is goddamn salt, I think. Isn't it all basically the same?
I assume this story ends with you getting the fries with sea salt, and there you have the answer to your question. No, it's better.
Am I so transparent? You see through me like cellophane, sir.
I was the same way. Sea salt, who cares? And I tasted it. Wow, that's delicious.
And it's, the thing is, I don't know if it's any more delicious than like the regular fat-ass fries than I normally, you know, it would get. But right. It's like they sell like sea salt and, you know, and pink salt and like Nepalese salt and mentholated salt and just salt of like every... Because my wife, you know, she's kind of like a low-grade sort of foodie. And right. So she'll come home with some salt that like... I know it's like $90 a pound or something, and it's like some you know, some like Iranian guy, you know, like working in a hut sold to her.
Right.
And so as I'm driving by the Wendy's, it's like, try our fresh cut fries with sea salt. And I swear to God, it was like, you hear people who have undergone like an alien abduction, and they're missing time, which like, and then I woke up and the probing was taken. And it's like, I remember seeing the sign that said, try our new fresh cut fry. And then honestly, I swear to you, I remember being in the car on the way home and the fries are on the seat next to me and I'm going, oh, these are so good. I don't remember actually ordering them. I don't remember paying for them. Mm-hmm. I don't remember making the conscious decision that it was a thing I need. It's just like that suddenly I was just there.
Yeah.
And also, here's another thing. How right were you when you said that it was like a one-step story that I was going to tell anyway and that it would end up being long and pointless? But here I am. It's like there's nothing I can do. I'm in it. Do I speak for everybody? And I think I do. Do I speak for everybody when I say this? There's something, I don't know what it is. There's some sort of magical aura or vibe that encircles the loose fries in the bag.
Those are better.
But why is that though? The loose fries in the bag on the. But the thing is, once you get home, they're not like they're not better. They some of the magical you know the whatever elixir they sort of contain has dissipated by then. It's not there anymore. But on the way home, the loose fries in the fast food bag, they're like the best thing you've ever had in your life.
I think it's because they feel like bonus fries, because it feels like, wow, they filled my fry box and threw a few in extra. Or these are the ones that tried to escape from the box and they made it as far as the bag.
I think you may be onto something when you say that they're bonus fries, because here's the thing, especially if you are buying fries for somebody else, mm-hmm. or if you're getting, like lunch for yourself and then also like the guy at work or whatever. Yeah. It's like the bonus fries are fries you can eat with impunity.
Yes.
Because it's like you're not stealing from him.
Exactly.
And it's also like you have all your own fries in the thing that you still have to get to. Like those are waiting in the future.
Right.
You're right. These are like they're like outtakes.
These fries are in no man's land.
Yeah, it really is. And so, but yeah. So then I'm just eating the loose fries on the way home, and so then I get home. And I go into my home office, and then I'm just sitting in the big ass-groove chair, and it's like I'm, you know, just eating, I'm just being such a parody of myself. I'm just sitting in the huge chair at home, watching Farscape on my laptop, just shoving a huge, and at some point during this like no man's land, during this sort of like vague,
this fugue state. This,
exactly. During this bizarre trench-like chunk of time during which I ordered the fries, they must have asked me whether I wanted a single or a double, and I said a double, and I don't know why. Wow. Some sort of part of my reptile brain opined that I needed twice the meat and bacon, of course. And so
sure,
there,
sure.
And then so then I'm at home just watching Farscape and just going and just shoving this whole, you know, just like a kraken, just consuming a whaling ship.
Yep.
I'm just putting the entire thing into my mouth. And so that I finish that, and then, you know, this is like, I don't know, like 7:15 or something. And then the next thing I know, it's like 7:50. And again, I'm just, I guess this seems to be a recurring pattern lesson. I'm just sitting there staring at the ceiling, realizing I haven't done anything, haven't accomplished anything, have in fact not even gotten rid of the fast food detritus, the litter that is just covering my lap.
Yeah.
And then he looked down, and it's like there's that horrible thing of like a dog is just licking one of the wrappers. It's like sitting on my thigh, and I, you know... Then it's like you realize that it's lucky that my wife wasn't there, because I was so filled with shame, I just wanted to set myself on fire like a monk. So I thought, well, what's the best way to cure all of this? I can just hit the reset button by taking a small nap.
Yes.
And, you know, which is, of course, like a completely deluded...
Sure.
I mean, that the thing is, and even as you say that to yourself, you know that's not true. You
right.
know it doesn't work.
Right.
Because for me, like, I'm not a guy that can take a nap in the evening and then I wake up refreshed. When I take a nap, like, that's it for me. Like, even if I get up later, I'm just going to be walking around in that weird sort of, like, where your nerves feel like they've been cheese grated,
yeah.
you know? And so I go to take a nap at, like, I don't know, 7:45, 7:50. And the next thing I realize is it is this morning at 9 a.m. And so that's what? That's 13 and a half hours.
Oh my gosh.
So, which is not, like, a thing that I typically do. So I just don't know if maybe it's all this sitting that I do here, and maybe the internal disintegration has already begun.
Did you sleep in the chair?
No, I went in and I crawled into bed, thinking to myself, with my shoes on. So this is a moment where my wife must have come home and just realized that she effectively has married like a 9-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
I really do feel for her at certain moments, like when she comes home and there's just fast food litter everywhere, and then also her husband is in bed with his shoes on. She must just think, like, what have I done? Like, why, of the hundreds of men that I could have married, up to and including the son of the guy who created WordPerfect, why did I marry this complete and total, like, shemp of a human? And there is no answer.
And all that could have been vetted if you'd had a standing desk.
That's right. There you go. The end. All right. Well, that was like 27 minutes. I'll never get back. Let's just, before we do anything else, let's see. We've got a telephone call. Hello, sir, madam, as the case may be. How can we help you on this fine Wednesday?
Hello, Rick. I have an answer to your salt question.
Yes. What is, okay, so this is about whether sea salt is different from regular salt.
Yes.
All right.
Sea salt is...
What's going on in the background there? Is there something yelping or chirping?
Not on my end.
Okay, never mind.
Did you bring Philo into the studio?
No, I'm hallucinating. Never mind, let's forget I said that. I'll take it out in post. Yes, so sea salt, regular salt, yes.
Sea salt is sort of harvested from basically evaporated seawater. And, like, table salt is mined.
So salt mines are not just a thing that my mother used sort of euphemistically as a way to describe me going off to school in the morning. There are actual mines of salt.
Yeah.
So salt mining, is that just like the West Virginia thing where you're just in there with a pickaxe, like singing a work crew song and taking out huge rocks of salt in cars?
I would assume at this point it's probably a little bit more high-tech. We've evolved past the Seven Dwarves era of mining.
Okay, there's no need to mock, sir. Just no need to make fun of my lack of excavational knowledge. I was just asking. But I mean, the mine is still basically just a big shaft drilled down into the ground, right? Or just dug out or something.
As far as I know.
I mean, it seems like, how else could they possibly, unless they have nanobots that go in?
From what I understand, it's a bunch of tunnels in the ground and they're digging salt out of it.
I just wonder what makes, if you're going to go to the trouble of mining, what makes you set out to find salt?
Seriously.
Instead of like gold or diamonds or
maybe it's
valuable.
One of many minerals that they find in a specific area.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
Maybe it's salt and, I don't know, iron or something.
Salted iron and fudge.
Okay.
Out of the fudge mines.
Thank you. I'm going to end this call now.
All right.
Okay, bye now. All right, thanks. There you go. Okay. I think the payoff was early on in that call, and everything else, but that was just a vapor trail. everything else was just a contrail. All right. It is the... So clearly my body is trying to tell me something. There's just something awful happening inside me, and it's just manifesting itself in all of these external, just all of these behavior patterns of mine.
Maybe your body's trying to tell you that you shouldn't get fast food and then sit down in the comfy chair and then sleep for 13 hours.
Except the thing is, yes, Mr. Snarky Snarky Pants, except that even before I even got the fast food, I had this weird sort of like...
Oh.
I had this weird sort of lost weekend... You know, this, like, blackout period where I, you know, like when you're re-entering the Earth's atmosphere, where I ordered, you know, a double beef thing with then, you know, bacon and fries. Anyways, just the whole thing. It
sounds delicious to me.
It really, well, here's the thing. And shamefully enough, it really was. It was fantastic. It's not so the Baconator. The Baconator's a thing that didn't live up to the hype in my.
I don't like food that seems like a challenge.
That's
like, oh, we dare you to eat it. Like, no thanks.
Can I tell you what got me to buy the Baconator?
Huh.
As dumb as this sounds, and this again is how easily I am marketed to. I'm just, first of all, I'm a sucker for things. Just the idea that it was called a Baconator, you know, I mean, there's something there. But also, I'm a sucker for anything that is sold to you in a flavor that seems like it shouldn't exist. Like when they had those Doritos that tasted like cheeseburger.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a thing that seems like a violation of God's law.
Right, yeah.
And so therefore, I was like, well, I got to eat it. But I swear to you, the thing that got me to try the Baconator when it first came out was just their tagline, which they had at the Wendy's places like forever. And it was a huge picture of the Baconator. And it just said in gigantic, like, 1,000-point type, it senses fear.
I remember that.
It's like, what does that even mean? Nothing. It means we've figured out a way to get 30-something white guys to buy this.
Yeah.
So, you know, mission accomplished. All right, well, there you go. Well, let's... I was going to say, let's do some new, but it really, we should take a moment to reset things here, probably. Okay. And then we will come back. We'll do some news. We'll welcome Anna Griffin from the Oregonian to the program, and so forth. You were listening to The Rick Emerson Show. We're accompanied today by Mr. Eric D. Snyder, and from he's from Movie BS with Baron Snyder at Cascadia.fm, also film.com, also EricDSnyder.com. Have I missed anything?
No, those are all the things.
Okay. You're not writing for, like, the community circular or that thing that goes up on the cork board out there in the common area at the apartment house?
Right, for the penny saver.
Exactly.
Do they still have that?
I don't know. They must. Probably. I don't know.
Okay. I realized as I asked right then I didn't actually care all that much.
And I don't actually know.
Excellent. We're all set.
We're a good team. You don't care and I don't know.
The circle is complete. You're listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Stay there. We're back right after this. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
If you want a good time, why don't you look me up? I never got the chance to make you mine. Why don't you look me up? I know you got my number around. Just call me up and we'll hit the time. Why don't you look me up? Why don't you look me up?
The Emerson News Network.
When the little blue bird who has never said a word starts to sing. Let's fall in love. I've heard that lizards and frogs do it, lying on a rock.
is a mothball.
The chimpanzees in the zoo do it. Some courageous kangaroos do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. I'm sure sometimes on the sly you do it. Maybe even you and I might do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. If you'd like to email, you can do that as well. It's rick at rickemerson.com. Or Mr. Eric D. Snyder can be emailed. Eric at ericdsnyder.com. Without further ado, we should just... hold on. Where's the... So welcome now to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thrice weekly columnist for the Oregonian and recently minted Nieman Fellow, Anna Griffin. Hello, how are you?
Hello.
All right, I want to point out, by the way, just here's what was happening during the break. So, because you and your whole family, so you're going to be sort of heading east at the end of July to begin your Nieman Fellowship at Harvard.
We're doing like a reverse Marty Moose trip, yes.
And it's going to be, what did you say, 3 weeks?
Yeah.
And so we were just, we were talking about, you know, what happens on the way and what sites there are to see and sort of what landmarks lie betwixt here and there. And I usually feel like such a tool because I can never tell where anything is. Like, I just, the map is just, once I get out of my front door, I mean, it's like the whole world is just this terrifying ball of mystery to me where things seem to shift in location constantly. Nothing is ever in the same place twice in a row. As opposed to my wife, who is just like a Jedi for finding her way everywhere. But just now, there was the most hilarious conversation we couldn't remember. And when I say we, I mean no one in this room could figure out what state was on top of what, where Idaho actually was, or if Wyoming was next to South Dakota.
Right.
Which apparently it is or is not.
No, it is right next to South Dakota.
I swear to God, I thought Wyoming was like next to Nevada or something.
No.
If you had asked me, like, where, I would have thought it was sort of like straight down from us and then ever so slightly to the right.
The problem with liberals, it's all flyover country. It's just all there somewhere.
Well, let's be honest. True. I mean, it's not like anything really happens in those states that I care about or that affects me in any way.
You must have been through Idaho at some point, mustn't you have?
Oh, yeah. Well, I lived in Spokane, so, I mean, But Idaho is not, like, I wouldn't have to go through Wyoming to get to Idaho.
Well, no, Wyoming is past Idaho.
That's what I'm saying. Right. So it's not like at any point I said, like, I'm lacking fun things to do in my life. Let's go to Wyoming.
I suppose.
So I sort of figured that Wyoming was down below us and to the right. And then and then, like, when I went to North Dakota at one point, North Dakota, I somehow thought it was sort of by Florida. And that's also not true.
No, it's pretty north.
It's almost Canadian, apparently.
It's just north of South Dakota.
Yeah, I know. It's
the great wilderness protecting us from Canada.
I am the ugly American. But also, it's like, but this is not even really is about that. It's about the fact that I just have no sense of direction. Like, I am the guy for whom the GPS was invented. And, you know, but my, like, the first couple times I went to New York, like, I would take cabs, not because, you know, because I'm opposed to rubbing shoulders with the great unwashed, but just because the subway terrified me.
Right.
It absolutely terrified me. And yet I go there with Laura, and she does that T-1000 thing of, like, she looks at the chart, you know, and the wall just zzzz, and just internalizes it and then just, like, knew everywhere we had to go.
Just have this image of you trying to get downtown from Midtown and winding up in Connecticut on the way.
No, I just had no – well, I mean, the classic story of me and my misdirection is the first Christmas after Laura and I had moved here from San Diego, we were trying to get from here to my hometown, which is a place called Kennewick, which is not like that far from here. And by the way, where I spent 18 years,
sure,
many of them driving back and forth from Portland because my grandparents lived here. And so Laura's like, well, do you know how to get there? And I'm like, baby, it's my hometown. I'm from there. Do I know how to get there? I'm basically Magellan, you know? And And I think because we had been together only, like maybe a year or something, and so I felt like I could kind of bluff my way through it and just sort of figure it all out.
And she assumed this was true because
she didn't know any better.
The glow was not off yet.
Well, I was saying much, like many things in our relationship, I was able to sort of swindle her into the deal before she kind of figured out the whole horrible truth.
Sure.
Before she figured out that maybe she didn't like hearing about, the 17th time that I saw Kiss in concert. But we're sort of driving, and then we end up, long story short, we end up in Le Grand. And Le Grand is not Kennewick, nor is it near Kennewick. It is in fact an entirely different place altogether, and so that was cause for much merriment and amusement with my family, and that gets rolled out every time my idiocy needs to be illustrated.
Here's a geographical tidbit of trivia that I've just discovered. Okay, you know how we live in the Northwest, but we don't think of Portland as being like super north. It's not like the great white snowy north. We're pretty much the same latitude as Minneapolis. Minneapolis is pretty much straight due east of us. Minneapolis is like snowy, Canada practically.
Is this a fact that I can use at some point in the future? Or is it just a thing that I can wheel out at cocktail parties?
In January, when the sun sets at 3:30 in the afternoon, yeah. You can point out to people it's because we're so far north.
Yeah, exactly. Geographically speaking, we're on the same
latitude.
Excellent.
Latitudes are the ones that go horizontal.
Can feel new folds developing in my brain as we speak.
This is really scintillating radio.
You should send this to the people at Harvard and be like, look, just in case you're not convinced, in case you, not yet sold, let me just oversell things right here.
And now do you have the Nieman Fellowship?
Yes.
We have to work with the person with the Marcus Fellowship?
Neiman Marcus. Hold on.
Neiman Marcus.
It took me a second. I'm a little slow.
I didn't even have the rim shot ready for that. So. What is going on in the in your world, Anna Griffin, in the world of the Oregonian?
I was driving here from downtown, and I saw at an intersection the mayor.
Was he next to you in a...
He had parked his city Prius sort of in an intersection, and he was out talking to a very angry-looking biker.
And was it did it look like an ad hoc conversation as though?
Well, it looked like what happens after a bike and a car run into each other.
Really?
Oh. Yes.
So you think Mayor Sam Adams hit a guy with his bike?
Well, no.
With his car?
The guy actually, it was a woman, and she actually hit him. He was apparently making a left turn and stopped the turn suddenly to avoid hitting a pedestrian. A good idea.
Where was this at? Like what area?
This is downtown at 4th and Columbia.
Oh, yeah. That whole place is just like, it's like an accident waiting to happen.
Right. So he's making a left turn, stops the left turn suddenly to avoid killing someone. Very good. Good judgment. And a biker just runs into the back of him.
Well, the thing about, because that's where those green boxes are, which is the thing
this
we sort of...
This is not a green box street. I know how you feel about the green boxes.
Well, exactly.
We can blame them if you want to.
I mean, I like to pin the blame for all things bicycle related on those. But it's like that whole... The thing about downtown is that it becomes such a huge pain is that you do have to navigate. There's like 9 different kinds of traffic. It's like there's the cars, there's the buses, there's bus lanes that just end suddenly. There's pedestrians, and then there's bicyclists.
And max trains.
And the max. And then there's always that guy, there's always that bicyclist that everybody hates, by the way, who's loathed by everyone on earth, and it is the guy who is whizzing between lanes of traffic that are either stopped or going too slow for his liking.
Share the road, dude.
Exactly. And it's, but he's the guy who's just navigating around all of the cars that happen to be stopped at a moment.
Right.
So it looks, so he was turning left. You think he stopped to avoid creaming a pedestrian and then was hit from behind by a cyclist. Did it look as though the cyclist was trying to pin all the, trying to blame all the blame on Sam Adams?
The cyclist, we actually had a reporter who was moving her car. Because, you can't park on the street all day long. So she was moving her car and saw it happen and was there in time to interview the cyclist who said something like, he stopped very suddenly.
Well, I see.
But anytime you rear-end someone, it's your fault. Like,
yes,
pretty much.
I believe that's right, even if you're in your bike.
Kind of
yeah.
always the rule that if you rear-end someone, it's your fault for following too close.
It's still one of those only in Portland, only Sam Adams kind of things.
Right.
Richard Daley did not go around really getting hit by bikers.
Well, and if he was, it was like you immediately apologized to him and you gave him all the money in your wallet.
Yes, my dead relatives will vote for your son someday.
Sorry, yeah. I just, please forgive me. I'm going to go flagellate myself.
And then I come down and stop at a coffee shop here on Southeast 11th near you guys. And I'm sitting there having a cup of coffee to prepare myself for the stress of coming in here. And I look outside.
You'll need more than coffee.
I needed, yeah. And there's a guy trying to put out flames that have erupted from his engine, and a coffee shop full of Portlanders, just none of them notice.
Really? Just sort of oblivious to the entire thing?
Just completely oblivious, yeah.
The thing about Portland, and specifically Southeast Portland, is somebody it's as Eric Bogosian might say, it's like a full-sized, fully immersive role-playing game, where you just never know what is lurking around any corner or what's going to confront you, like, at any time at all.
I was looking around the coffee shop, and it was that, you know, you had the cute lesbians flirting with each other, you had the guy who's clearly writing his Robots Take Over the World novel with his headphones on.
Sure.
You had the older couple looking around at people with tattoos because they'd never seen that before. It was like, and then you had obnoxious me sitting there also not helping the guy because I'm taking pictures of it with my iPhone.
Of course. Well, there's always a guy, by the way, who is balding, thin hair on top, but then a long ponytail.
Oh, yeah.
That's arguing about either Frank Zappa or jazz recordings with somebody else. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's Wednesday. Mr. Eric D. Snyder in for Don Taylor. We'll talk more about the happenings at and in the pages of the Oregonian here in just a few, but we should actually get some real news done. Hold on. Let's see if I can find some. Wait. There we go.
And
excellent.
Now,
fantastic.
From the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Here is Mr. Eric D. Snyder.
But that man just said Don Taylor.
Yes, I know. It's a web of lies and deceit.
I feel like we need to go over the bottle of urine story.
Okay.
See, the trouble started with a bet over a bottle of urine. Brian Hamidl was playing poker in an all-night game with Kyle Tarborough at a Bethlehem Township home. This would be in Pennsylvania. When he told Tarborough that he had urine stored in his vehicle that Tarborough could use to cheat on a drug test.
How would that come up well, first of all,
it was like, hey, buddy, you have that drug test coming out. I got a bottle of pee out in the car that's clean.
Is it a thing that he was just toting around with him? Like, was it just like a video you keep meaning to return to the store and you haven't yet?
these are the questions that his buddy Kyle had. Kyle's like, they bet $300 on whether Brian actually had the urine in his car. So because Kyle, like, he was like saying, why would you have a bottle of pee in your car? You're lying to me. And
so this wasn't about whether the urine would in fact help him beat the drug test. It was whether the bottle of urine in his car even existed.
Exactly. All right. Exactly. They were betting on the existence of a bottle of pee.
$300?
Well,
poker, so.
It's an all-night poker game, and it's guys named Brian and Kyle. I'm going to assume that there was a lot of alcohol involved.
You would think the guy claiming to have the urine in his car would know if he had urine in his car.
Well, but the other guy's like, that's so absurd. I think you're lying to me.
I will give you $300 if you have that bottle of urine.
Yeah,
but
pretty much.
I can see how it happens.
So it was almost like it was like some sort of a horrible Monty Hall kind of a thing. Like, if you have a toaster in your pants, I will give you.
Okay. So Brian's the one who says he has the pee out in the car. Kyle says, no, there's no way. But Kyle's the one who needs the pee for the drug test. So they bet $300, and then when the game wrapped up, Kyle demanded the money or the urine. Said either give me the money or give me the pee. And then the other guy said the bet was absurd. So I bet now
I'm so confused. I have completely lost
the guy who claimed to have the pee in the first place is now saying, no, that was a stupid bet. Come on. We're not to the part yet, actually, whether he actually had the pee or not. I myself
don't even know. See,
I don't know either.
I feel like I'm watching Twin Peaks, where I honestly couldn't tell you right now.
But if you're suddenly at the end of it going, no, this bet's absurd.
That sounds you don't have the
pee. It sounds like
you don't have
the pee. I don't know if that's my penis or not. It sounds like you know that's your penis.
Well, we didn't get that far because when he said, no, this bet is dumb, the guy who needed the pee for his drug test beat him up. He beat him up, put him in the hospital for 4 days, and stole a roll of cash from his pocket.
And the pee from his car.
And the pee from his car.
I like the idea that there were a couple of outcomes here. There was he either has the pee and gets paid. He doesn't have the pee and he has to pay. I never saw this sort of like Kobayashi Maru, like third. Instead, I'm just going to pummel you into dust and steal all the money in your pockets.
Right. Police arrived about 7 a.m. and found Brian semi-conscious inside the house. Kyle told officers that two men had burst into the house and attacked him.
Wait, is he still at the house where the poker game is taking place?
Yeah, and apparently the guy who had beaten him up and stolen his money is still there. And he tells the cops, oh, some dudes busted in and beat him up.
What kind of a card game is this? I don't understand. And especially because there must have been other people there the entire time.
Yeah.
Sort of, it doesn't concern me.
Poker. It's actually Magic the Gathering.
I get, or the guys from the coffee shop where you were, where they were just sort of willfully oblivious to the entire thing.
No, it went to court, and the jury found Kyle Tarborough, guilty of simple assault. Not complicated assault, just simple assault.
This is really the most complicated kind of assault.
It was simple assault. false imprisonment and making false reports to the police. He was acquitted of robbery and of aggravated assault.
Okay, look, you bastard. At no point have you clarified the issue of the existence or non-existence of the bottle of urine. Unless it's like a Schrodinger's urine.
The bottle of urine appears in the first act. It must go off in the third act.
I believe the bottle of urine is, in this case, the MacGuffin.
It exists solely to instigate.
Really, yeah. I feel like I'm already at Harvard.
You could probably crank an entire thesis out about this.
Whether or not the bottle of urine existed is beside the point.
Well,
it sounds like it probably didn't. The point was when he failed to produce it, his buddy who wanted it and who had bet him over it beat him up.
You know, Don would have just made up something about the urine.
It's true. The
bottle of urine was called to testify.
My thing is like what was the guy's presumable goal in fabricating, if he did, the existence of a bottle of urine? Like, was he trying to impress the guy? Like, sort of a Boy Scout kind of, I am prepared for any eventuality.
I can actually imagine that. You're a bunch of idiots sitting around playing poker. You're tipsy. And someone's like, oh, dude, I gotta take a drug test, but I take drugs all the time, so I wish I had some clean pee. And the other guy's like, I got a bottle of pee out in the car. And then, like, you make up a story. Like, yeah, I was on a road trip and peed in the bottle and never threw away. Yeah, it's totally out there. You can have it. And
is that something guys would do?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Well, I have to say that guys really do some ridiculous things. So it's
that's absolutely a thing that guys would do.
The idea that a guy wouldn't do something because it's too dumb or absurd,
but
that doesn't really...
But you then just, like, forget that you have a bottle of urine in your car and just
I could see that being believable. Like, yeah, well, maybe he just got back. I don't know what story he made up about why he had the bottle of pee, but he apparently sold it and sold the story.
And I got to tell you, and just having lived, like, not only having lived on my own for quite some time when I was younger, but also, like, having lived in a couple, like, sort of, you know, I would live in, like, one sort of house of dudes after another. Mm-hmm. And it was, like, the things that you would just find, like, either in the kitchen or just, like, wrapped up in the fridge or just, like, you know. I mean, let's be honest. Dawn has, like, one of her own, like a part of one of her femurs, like, in a box in the freezer.
That's true.
So, I mean, really, it's not like that's even limited to guys as such, but it does tend to be, you know.
A bottle of pee in the car is actually at the normal end of the spectrum.
Yeah, I would say in terms of just,
odd places.
You know, it's like if you got to, you know, like you got to make that, you know, you got to make that newspaper delivery run, you know, and you don't have time for, you know, there's no time to spare. I mean,
what you're telling me is my son should never have his own room.
No.
There'll be so many bottles of pee.
No, I kept a huge, at one point I remember my mom when I was like, I don't know, like 5 or 6 or something, I just a gigantic plastic bag full of earthworms in my room that I think I had brought them in because I was intending to take them over to a friend's house and show them, like, look, bag full of earthworms. But then I forgot about them, and then she found them like a month or two later. And so, you know, that's just a, you know, I don't think that thing that ever gets fully trained out of the average guy. It's just sort of there. Okay.
Yeah,
that was a long way to get to the end of that story where we find out that it's all just sort of a, it's all just, you know, everything has just vanished into the ether right in front of us.
Our hand closes
on nothing in the darkness of the story.
We will never know whether there was a bottle of pee, although it seemed like there was not, or else he would have just.
We're really the true victims in this story. We really are.
I agree.
It's sort of common sense, I guess, that if there is a bottle of pee, he's going to take the money and walk away.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So. Okay. That's for the court to decide.
Just have kind of a cleansing moment here before we do anything else. Okay. You're listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. We're here with Anna Griffin from the Oregonian. Also, Mr. Eric D. Snyder in for Don Taylor. And he is at the news desk with this.
Remember how Bob Barker died? Well, he didn't. He's still alive. And he now that he doesn't have his show anymore, he had that game show. Where he would and it'd give people money and stuff if they'd guess prices of things. And now he's done with that. He got fired from that. And so now he's going around Badmouth and SeaWorld.
Well, that's what he does. He's sort of a, because mm-hmm. that's the bulk of his time and energy goes toward, it's like the, because he's the keep your pet spayed or neutered.
Right, right.
Exactly.
He's in a new PETA TV spot urging people not to go to the SeaWorld parks in Orlando, San Antonio, and San Diego. In the video, Bob Barker claims that some orcas at SeaWorld were taken from their family pods in the ocean and are now forced to swim in small concrete tanks where they perform what Bob Barker calls dumb tricks. dumb tricks like spinning a giant wheel for $1,000.
You know, which is a thing I couldn't do. Let's be honest.
Dumb tricks like running around changing price tags in 30 seconds till you get them all right. Dumb tricks like that, Bob Barker?
I was ripped from my family and forced to bid on the Showcase Showdown.
Can I just tell you this? I have like five thoughts on this. I'll start with thought number four. Mm-hmm. That I know somebody who toured the Price is Right studio. They got the whole soundstage where they filmed that. And then they were given the opportunity to spin the wheel, and then they just didn't do it. They just didn't do it. That's what I'm saying. That's exactly my reaction, Eric D. Snyder.
That's ridiculous.
She's like, well, I was just there with some friends, and like they knew a guy who was a guard, and so they toured the center, and they showed us the big wheel, and I was like, and you spun it? And she said, well, no, we just looked at it. And I was like, what do you mean? You couldn't? And they're like, no, we just, some people did. I just didn't. I was, I wanted to get lunch. I'm like, what do you mean you didn't?
Basic life rule.
Exactly.
You spin the wheel.
And so I told her she was a bad American. That is like renouncing your citizenship by not spinning the wheel.
To be given an opportunity.
Okay, I'm glad we're all on the same page here.
It feels like a sign of depression.
It is. I mean, really, it's...
It's in the commercials. Lose interest in spinning the giant wheel.
Also, my brother
no
went.
Appetite.
My brother went to basic training when he enlisted with the Marines. He was in boot camp not too far from there. And I have never forgiven him for the fact that when he had, they get, after we're done, you get, a week of leave or something. And he had, the full, dress, but and, dude. Yeah. You're right there. They film it, down the street from me. Again, two people in a row in my life have an opportunity to do something before because they always call
when
the Marine
you have
guys up.
The chance to come on down. You go on down.
Because the thing that I never realized, the curtain gets pulled back and everything. When you're an adult, you just lose this veil of illusion that that covers all things when you're a child. I always just bought into the idea that it was pure luck. It was just a happenstance.
Just random.
But I didn't know they did a pre-interview on Wheel of Fortune where the guy talks to you and he sees if you have some sort of an interesting life story or if you're going to be some embarrassing guy with a speech impediment because they don't want you up there. Well, seriously, you don't want to get
do not want to frighten grandma and grandpa when they watch The Price is Right. No.
Yeah. I mean, so it's if they're just going to ask you, so where are you from? And you just bark or something in response. They don't want that.
I think that would go over better on the Drew Carey version probably than the Bob Barker version. What do you bid? 666.
I just told my brother, you're right there. You got to go. And he's like, I don't know. I was thinking I'd just go get some coffee somewhere and relax, for a couple of days. I'm like, nah, whatever, fine. So there's that. Also, here's the thing about Bob Barker and his animal rights stuff is, and I'm serious about this, that I think Bob Barker is one of the handful of people on television who has that sort of Mr. Rogers-like ability mm-hmm. who by dint of, he wouldn't even have to nag or browbeat, just by dint of his cultural
his
relationship to us. Yes, the fact that he is woven through the cultural fabric like a comforting blue thread. He could just say, well, I'd prefer it if you didn't go to SeaWorld. And then he just looks at you with that caring sort of Bob Barker, kind of expression that he has down pat. And it's like, I think that would be enough to guilt me out of it.
That's the thing is I hate PETA so much, but if they got Bob Barker pointing out and these poor orcas were taken from their family pods and PETA says that at least 23 orcas have died in SeaWorld facilities since 1986 from causes other than old age. And I don't know if that's – I don't know how often orcas die out in the wild of causes other than old age. But it makes you feel, well, maybe Bob Barker's right.
I think in the wild they die by being eaten by great white sharks.
Yeah.
That could be.
Yeah. So they're clearly – I don't know who approached who there, but they're obviously onto something by using the Bob Barker thing.
Oh, yeah.
Because you would feel bad if you let him down. Mm-hmm. If Bob Barker – if you ran into him in the street and he said, where are you going? Well, I just came from – SeaWorld. And he just looked at you with that and he sort of shook his head slowly. It's like, it would be, it'd be like stealing from your grandfather.
Yeah. On the other hand, though, SeaWorld's really fun.
I just like the scenario there, the hypotheticals. Okay, you're walking down the street. You just left SeaWorld.
You're wearing your SeaWorld t-shirt.
And you run into Bob Barker.
I mean, wouldn't you just – I think I would just take my life before he even had the chance to pass judgment. But hold on, Bob Barker. Give me just a second. I would just harikiri right there on the sidewalk.
I think you drive to SeaWorld. I don't think there's any walking involved.
Probably not.
What he ought to do is he ought to stand outside of SeaWorld and just give people a sad look.
They should – oh, my God. They should totally have a huge billboard where he just is sort of just looking at you with that look of I'm not angry, I'm just disappointed.
Or if next door Bob Barker, and a wheel to spin.
That's so great.
Next door to SeaWorld.
See, because like the thing about SeaWorld is like you just there's this long, I used to live not too far from there, and it's just and it's kind of set off like from everything,
right?
There's just this long drive of just a whole lot of nothing before you get there, where you could easily purchase and then erect some sort of a billboard there. That would be fantastic.
If you had to guess how old Bob Barker is, what would you say?
78.
87.
Really?
He's 87.
You know, still spry, though. Yeah. I bet here's the thing about Bob Barker. I bet he still gets him some action, too.
I'm sure he's still handsy.
Well, because he's got like $1 billion, right? Isn't that whole... Did you ever see that interview with him where he was... Because he was funding that boat that just goes out and just like gets in the way of Japanese whaling ships. Mm. And there was this... I wish I had the article in front of me, but it was... But there was a transcript of this, but it was... He actually said this, because... There's that, and I think they made a show of this. Is it Whale Wars? Is that the show on Discovery or whatever? Where there's these guys, these sort of like PETA or, you know, like Greenpeace guys. I think it was actually Greenpeace, where they have these little jet boats, and the deal is it's like the whales are here, the whaling ship is over here, and they like run the gauntlet between the two to try to block it. And so one of them, it is, I swear to God, it's called like the SS Bob Barker or something. And they're like, well, what is up with that? And it turns out, well, Barker funded the whole thing. And there's this interview with him where they asked like how that came to pass. And I'll have to track down the soundbite because it's just like the best thing you've ever heard. He's describing how he was approached by Greenpeace to fund one of these boats that blocks whalers. And this is now what Bob Barker said. He said, quote, so they had a boat, but they needed some money to fund it. And I had $5 million. So I said, let's get it on. And I remember just thinking to myself, like, that is the best quote that's ever been uttered by anybody.
Good for you, Bob Barker.
Yeah, I mean, seriously. I mean, you know, because otherwise what you can do, just sit at home and just wait for your bones to turn to dust. I mean, you know, if you got money, you might as well do something fun with it.
Might as well.
Excellent. Here's Mr. Eric D. Snyder filling your head full of tasty knowledge.
Let's do a soundbite thing. This will be fun. Let's do this one.
Are you saying that is sort of a, like if you say it like Beetlejuice, it'll actually come to pass?
Yeah.
It'll be fun? Or
do you want to talk about Gaddafi?
More than anything.
Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi sounded defiant today in a live audio broadcast. Through a translator, he called the conflict with NATO a fight to the finish.
Is there actually a conflict happening? I mean, I don't mean to sound daft, but are we actually, is there like an actual...
Sort of. Kind
war,
of.
War, like a conflict happening now?
You work at a newspaper, is there?
Anna Griffin?
Yes, there is.
Okay.
All right.
Is that like American troops? Are they sort of on the ground, or is it just kind of a...
It is some NATO forces, NATO aid forces at least, helping out the guys that Gaddafi wants to kill because they don't like him.
Okay, so it's sort of a...
How is that for a really pared down
so it's like we're just
explainer.
So it's like a sort of we are aiding.
Some of the locals want to take him out, and we're sort of helping them with that a little bit.
It's sort of part of the whole Arab Spring thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see, this is...
Which is not as refreshing as Irish Spring.
We will not surrender. We will not give up. We have one option, our country. We will remain in it until the end. Dead, alive, victorious, it doesn't matter.
Was that a computer?
I was just going to say it. It sounds as much as Microsoft Sam is now Muammar Gaddafi's mouthpiece.
We will not surrender.
They should require the translators to do an impression of the person they're translating for.
We will not surrender. We will not give up. We have.
It does
one
have
option.
That clipped, our very country. Angular.
We will remain in it until the end. Dead, alive, victorious. It doesn't matter.
Mm. Okay. Well, there you go. So, I mean, the thing about about Gaddafi is he's like one of those Castro guys where it's like every single president just says, like, you know, and now we got to get to do. We have to move, you know, move, make him an action item and get rid of him. And then he's just there.
Well, it became less of a priority when he stopped helping people blow up our airplanes.
Right.
I don't mean to sound dumb about this. Why did it suddenly become a priority again? Was it because he was doing that whole like crushing of dissent thing? But I assume that's like an ongoing state of existence in Libya, like all the time.
To this degree, it's fairly new. It is out and out warfare in Libya now.
All right.
Yeah, and he was sort of replaced on the world stage by like Hussein and Bin Laden and all that. There are crazier, more violent people who sort of stole his thunder.
Now, I wonder if that was the thing where he felt like he had to step it up because it's like he wasn't, you know, he was no longer
the way Bill O'Reilly's been acting crazier ever since Glenn Beck.
Exactly. I was gonna go sort of Dennis Rodman, you know, I have no conclusion statement to that. I was gonna say Dennis Rodman is the new, or somebody is the new Dennis Rodman, but I have nothing. All right, there you go. Excellent. We might as well just get these Anthony Weiner cuts out of the way so we can, because that's an inevitability. So we might as well just do it now.
All right.
Somebody in this room sounds as though she's very tired of the story.
Did you know he was so muscular?
No, here's the thing. He's got. Can I just tell you this? He's got like a full-on Wrath of Khan chest.
I mean, you see him in a suit, and he looks like kind of this scrawny guy who maybe runs.
Like a little wiener.
But he's kind of cut up top.
Yeah. No, he did. Well, that was the thing that Jon Stewart kept talking about. He's just like, you know, because they were roommates. And he's just like, I can't believe this guy's the same age as I am. He's like, look at him. And I mean, he really does. I mean, it is. And plus, the other thing about him is he has. And sometimes this looks a little weird. He's one of those guys who has like zero body fat. And so everything, like any time he would make any sort of facial expression, it kind of looked as though he was a really angry skull. You know? Or, you know, it just looked as though he was, it looked as though somebody had just put a hose inside of him and it just sucked everything out. He looked very, very cross, like all the time. Okay, so I have the cuts ready here.
Yeah, all right. How does Democratic Congressman Anthony Weiner handle the aftermath of his admitting to lying about sexually provocative photos he posted on Twitter? Democratic strategist Robert Zimmerman says it won't be easy.
Is this cut three?
Mm-hmm.
He's got to get through the hurdles of the Ethics Committee. He has to then not just worry about his constituents, but also worry about whether he'll have a district to run for.
By the way, and apparently his wife wasted no time in getting like to the other side of the planet and hanging out with Hillary Clinton, who... That's got to be an interesting conversation.
I feel really middle-aged asking this, but do people actually use Twitter for this purpose?
You mean for penis mailing?
Yeah,
what
exactly.
What I gather, he sent it as a private message to somebody
specifically. Right, as a direct message. Yeah. But even still, it 140 characters doesn't seem like a lot for
well,
sexting.
If you're just sending a link to a twit pic or whatever.
So he's sort of the digital version of a 60-second man. He's just sort of a kind of, you know, just get the job done as quickly as
you just
as
need
possible.
To see it to know, baby.
The thing about like using it's like Twitter is, you know what Twitter is? As we were talking about this, I think, during the break, that you said that we were talking about Dawn getting a new apartment, and you said the only reason you knew that, Eric, is because she inadvertently like told everyone in the universe about it via Twitter with like a whole like, so I'll move in on Sunday then or whatever, which it's not like it was anything, you know, sort of private or untoward or whatever. But Twitter seems to be this sort of like conversational or communicative gauntlet where you are constantly in jeopardy of doing the reply all to everybody. Because I've actually done that. I did the it's funny with the extra comment, but I totally forgot about this. But I did this a couple weeks ago where somebody had sent a direct message to me or they posted a Twitter question to me, and it was, I guess, public. And I thought I was replying directly with my email address. And then Cheryl texted me like 5 seconds. She's like, did you just put your email address on Twitter? Don't ever do that. It's, you know, you get harvested by spammers. And I was like, no. I direct message. How do you know? And she's like, it wasn't a direct message, jackass.
Yeah.
Like, you send it to everyone. And I had no idea. So, I mean, that's.
And you thought to yourself, thank God it wasn't a picture of my penis.
Seriously. Because I had been toying. You know, it was really, it's always just like I flip a coin. So I don't know. I mean, it's like, to me, the thing is like, he didn't even have the brains to make up like a fake.
This is
sort
what
of.
Gmail is for.
Yeah, I don't know why he didn't just email it. I don't understand.
Gmail
doing that
is
on Twitter.
For Craigslist listings.
Yeah.
And online sex. I mean, that's it.
That's all I use it for.
You should put that as just, you know, that should just be your signature file from now on, just on your email address. So, all right. So he has much work to do. Other cuts here.
Yeah, there's Zimmerman, the strategist, has some advice for Weiner.
Right now for Anthony Weiner, it's really about showing true remorse and removing politics from the calculation.
All right.
I am really, really sorry you all saw my penis.
Except, do we know if there was even like an actual uncovered photo of the or was it
allegedly
all just
there's one out now.
Well, that's
has
what Breitbart
it,
says
been,
that he's got
seen?
One that he's holding.
I did not click on the HuffPost link because I was at work.
But allegedly, one has been posted now.
Oh, okay, so there's so that's, he okay, so there is like an
so
actual.
There is a smoking gun.
All right, okay,
so to speak.
Yes.
Zimmerman says Weiner's not off to a good start.
The one rule,
really? Do you think?
The one rule in crisis communication is to get your story out there, because if you don't, someone else is going to write the story. You can't get away with certainly lying and then insulting the media for not believing your lies.
See, the thing is, like, maybe he knew that there was this nude photo of his member that was out there, because I was just sort of rooting for him just to dig in and just to never admit it. Like, that was the thing that I took this perverse glee in, is the fact that he just refused to say one way or the other.
It seems so ridiculous. And then he was asked about it, and you remember, was it last week, that he basically said, I can neither confirm nor deny if that is my package in that photo.
Right.
And at that point, it was like, you know what? You know your own underwear.
Yeah.
Right. Well, if that's all it was just, the underwear photo, so what?
But
if there's
not,
actually,
because
that's not
actually. If you can't categorically say I have never taken a picture of my own junk, you probably should not be in public office.
Right.
Well, that is a fair point. I mean, just think about, here's the thing that I think about constantly, though, maybe way more than other people do, is that, you know, with the proliferation of, you know, the technology and broadband and readily, available communication tools on your laptop and your phone or whatever. I mean, didn't it seem like we're going to reach some sort of event horizon within the next, like, 15 or 20 years where, like, everybody who runs for office will have some, like, sex video of them that, like, you know, that, like, they took in their sophomore year of college that ended up on the internet?
I do not want to see Barbara Boxer's sex video, okay?
I mean, I think that at some point we're going to have to relax the standards. Like just a little bit, because I think everybody will have a MySpace picture of themselves that's just like lingering out there somewhere.
Well, and the problem is, you know, we get so caught up in all these things on the sex, on the picture of the penis, on was the kid 17 or 18 when they kissed, on, you know, how much was Elliot Spitzer paying for it? When it's not about the sex, it's about the judgment behind the sex.
Right.
I suppose. I mean, but I. You're giving. Okay, you're giving me the look.
I'm giving you the mom look, aren't
I? No, I wasn't going to say the mom look because I have used that phrase
before. Now, Rick.
I have said to people, "Oh, you give me the mom look," and then I have, and then apparently that is a thing that occasionally is taken as an insult because then it's like, you know, I don't know why it's.
Well, I mean, on the one hand, I think there are people out there who can be completely undisciplined in their personal life and be totally fine and cool in their professional life, but I think that's the exception, not the norm.
Well, see, and that's my thing is like I take it as an article of faith that there are people who are able to have that sort of, you know, the line of demarcation in their own head between, you know, that they can get one job, they can multitask.
They can be idiots in private but still do a good job with
You
are dumb enough to get caught.
I guess it's like, you know, you hear, but there are functional alcoholics and functional drug addicts. So if you're a functional, like, penis, you know, texter, it's like, I mean, and I'm not, you know, and I'm not from New York, so I don't know. I mean, do we know, like, was he good at his job, like, apart from this? I mean, was he a guy who got stuff done?
See, that I think he was. And that's what I was going to say is that it seems like, I tend to agree that usually if you're a screw up in your private life, you're going to be bad at your job, too. But, well, you know, look at his record. Look at the fruits. You know, if he's been doing a good job, then, you know.
See, that's just like I was saying about the whole thing with Sam Adams. It's like, you know, breed love, schmied love. Like, I got, you know, like there are potholes on my street. Fix them. And that's all that's all I care about. I care about so little, of this. I mean, as long as the guy's like not overtly, you know, kind of screwing up at work all the time. So, you know, but
I tend to agree. I just think
breed love, schmied love would be a good name for a musical.
Yes. It's the. We'll just sell that to Carrie Brownstein right now. It's not like the guy, you know, showed impeccable judgment. But I mean, also, and maybe this is.
It's not like he showed impeccable judgment.
Well, look,
really? That is a bold statement to make, Rick Emerson.
I just realized that guys are just fundamentally idiots.
Have you ever taken a picture of yourself?
I have not. No, I have. In fact, as Dom will tell you, there was this day that I came in here from the restroom, and I was sort of, and I had been. I had been using the bathroom for its primary purpose, and I was then checking my email at the same time, and then there was this sort of ching sound, like with the shutter closing on a camera, and I came and it was such an awkward because I came in back and I said, "Hey, so you have an iPhone? Look, I may have just taken a picture of my area. You have to, and it turns out that there's a thing where you can screen cap whatever's on.
Yeah.
But I didn't because I'd only had the thing for like a month, and I didn't know you could sort of accidentally, like if you press the top button and the whatever you could do. And there was like about 40 seconds there where I was unsure if I just sent a picture of my business to everybody like on the planet. So no, and
imagine the call you'd get from Cheryl then.
I just. And I mean, and there, as a story that I think I told last week or a couple weeks ago when this started happening, there was back in my when I was a Ute, there was a woman that I dated is probably too strong of a term, but there was a woman that I spent the biblical time with at one point in the past who expressed interest in preserving that evening or that series of undoubtedly disappointing moments and I was just like, no, thank you. Rick Emerson is not interested in that. And in fact, I was so not interested in that because she said, so I've got, you're here. I've got this camera. How about we? And I was like, wow. No. No, thank you. And then like later on, like 5 or 10 minutes later, like she asked again, she's like, you're sure? I mean, it was like nobody would see it. And I think at that point, I was so weirded out, I actually just left.
Wow.
Like I was sort of like so not into that idea. Well, because that's just, you know.
That's weird.
And that was even before like the internet was really sort of ascendant in the way we know it now. And not like I plan to run for Congress, but you just know that something weird is going to end up happening. Like that's going to end up being a thing that like, you know, her kid is having like some Dora the Explorer party and the tapes get all mixed up and then it's like I'm in handcuffs and it's like I don't even, you know, so
sure.
No.
Swiper, no swiping.
Yeah, so I, you know, but I do recognize that we were talking about fugue states earlier with my thing yesterday of not remembering that I'd gone through the drive-thru at Wendy's.
Yeah.
I think that like the guys and like hormones, I do think that there is like some the weird tranquilizing ability that happens, this effect that happens on part of your brain. Or it's like you come out of the other side of this tunnel and you're not entirely sure what you've done over the last, you know, like 19 minutes or why you decided to do it.
And you're like, oh, did I really bet a guy $300 and he didn't have a bottle of pee in his car?
I mean, you know, so and plus and the other thing is that guys never remember like Tom Likas used to refer to as like the unbreakable rules, which is that, you know, she will always tell somebody. Always, yep. All sister, mother, hairdresser.
We are so much meaner than you are.
Yeah, it's
never forget
yeah,
that.
It will never stay private. She will always tell someone. But when this first happened, my whole thing was wondering whether it was he actually did it under his own name or whether it was done as like, you know, Ramrod 75 or whatever. And it's like that's, you know, and then she put the pieces together eventually of like, oh, this is that guy.
Yeah.
So, you know. Mm.
Sexy Congressman 202.
Yeah, yeah.
It is, you know. Your camera, your iPhone, whatever, it's the same rule as, you know, like in a cop drama. You never stick it down your pants, okay? You get a holster for it.
Exactly.
It's a good policy.
All right. Here is Mr. Eric D. Snyder at the news desk.
Here, this story will make you outraged, make you shake your head and shake your fist. You'll shake everything. There'll be a lot of shaking going on after this. A Colorado soldier says that he and his fellow troops got an unfriendly welcome home from Delta Airlines on Tuesday. The troops say they paid nearly $3,000 in excess luggage fees on a flight home from Afghanistan. And they weren't coming back with just like souvenirs and trinkets. They had like, you know, their, you know, military stuff, whatever soldiers have. This guy, Robert O'Hare, he says the Army orders authorized 4 bags. When they arrived at the Delta ticket counter, the soldiers claimed they had to pay $200 each for the fourth bag. Quote, we had 4 bags. Delta Airlines only allows 3 bags. We had to actually end up paying out of pocket our own money. He says, for me, it was a weapons case holding my M4 grenade launcher and 9mm, the tools that I used to protect myself and Afghan citizens while I was deployed.
Well, but what is the – so is he at the counter and they said, do you have anything else? And he says, well, just this grenade launcher.
Well,
and
the thing is he's trying to check 4 bags and they only allow you to check 3 bags. So he has to pay $200 for the fourth bag.
Are you surprised that there isn't more? I mean, I'm not advocating or encouraging this. This is not a thing that I'm promoting. But are you surprised that there haven't been – just more cases of just people that they get a pat down or getting their stuff searched or being told they got to check a thing, and then they just either get sick of it and they just whack the TSA guy like right in the face. Mm. I mean, you think about the number of unstable people walking around this country and then the number of those people who fly every year, and it seems like just the law of averages, you know,
yeah.
Just the math of it, it would have given us more fisticuffs than this by now.
You think? Yeah, I don't know. And this is even before we got that far. This is the ticket counter, and I like the response from Delta's spokeswoman Betsy Telton. She says, Delta has great appreciation for our military and offers flexibility for active duty U.S. military personnel traveling on orders with up to 4 complimentary checked bags in first class business class and 3 complimentary checked bags in coach. In other words, she reiterated what the soldier had already said, which is that we're only allowed 3 bags and charges for the fourth. That's how they appreciate military is by.
That's a nice way of saying, yes, you do owe $200.
Yeah, exactly. Each. Yeah, that's
it's a limited kind of appreciation.
Yeah.
It's a strictured kind.
And then she didn't respond to an email request for an interview. American Airlines faced a similar situation in 2008 when it was widely criticized for charging troops excess baggage fees. The airline eventually agreed to waive the fees. And I suspect these soldiers will be reimbursed by the Army. But still.
I think we just soldiers get a break.
Exactly.
I think we all agree on that.
You're coming home. Like, they were coming directly from Fort Polk in Louisiana, but it was on their way back from Afghanistan.
Right. If you're coming back from, say, a war zone,
sure.
I don't know. Maybe we can cut you a break.
And yeah, and if it's your own personal stuff and you picked up some souvenirs and you brought back, you know, a bust of Saddam Hussein or whatever.
If you have the corpse of an Afghani who you killed, that's one thing.
You have to check that. That's
But if this is your stuff, this is your. By the way, I'm not gonna anger a man who's got a bag with an M4 grenade launcher and 9mm.
Seriously, that's a let the Wookiee win kind of a situation.
Is that
right there? Is where you just, you know.
Oh, is that what's in the bag? Oh, that bag's free then.
I mean, it doesn't have to escalate too many levels before you've lost, like, irrevocably.
Yeah.
You were listening to the sorry about snorting into the microphone just there. You were listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. We're here with Mr. Eric D. Snyder, sitting in for Don Taylor, who will be returning tomorrow. Also, Anna Griffin, Thrice Weekly columnist from the Oregonian. What is coming up in your fine paper that people might be able to avail themselves of?
You know, we have the mayor being hit by bikeless. We have tomorrow I'm going out to an elementary school in southeast Portland to watch small children get books, so I'll be writing something heartwarming about that.
When you say to get books.
I wrote...
Have these children never seen books before?
Things are really bad in Portland Public Schools, let me tell you.
It's in Lent.
Really rough. You guys should have voted for that bond.
I did.
What's the program?
Earlier this year, I wrote a story about a librarian at Kelly Elementary School in Lent who had read a column in the New York Times showing that kids, especially poor kids, over the summer get as much benefit from having books of their own to read, to take home and read, as they do from summer school.
Okay, yeah. See, now I feel like a jerk. I just said Lent as like a go-to.
And it actually is Lent.
Lent is always sort of the place that I'd bring that out of my bag as the punchline.
Well, we had a story earlier where a guy stabbed a guy in Lent.
A little road rage incident. Yeah.
Yes.
It led to stabbing.
All right. So, okay. See, now I feel like I have to retrospectively make the joke about someplace else.
Lent is sort of our shorthand now for...
Well, it's just, you know, it's not like it's a real it's not like it's a place that's real flush with with funds and opportunities for many people.
That's true. So this librarian, she has this great idea to do a book drive, and to at the end of the year let kids at this school, which is, you know, not the most affluent school and has a large immigrant population and has a lot of families, you know, with single parents or both parents work, and so
a lot of stabbings.
The idea at the end of the year is to let the kids essentially go shopping for a bunch of books to take home over the summer.
That's
stuff
fantastic.
They want to read.
See, I'm a huge... See, that's... I never understand people who, and this happened actually in Utah when I lived there. This is a thing where Utah, as family-oriented as Utah and as like Salt Lake County where there would constantly be just these huge fights about whether to approve funding for like public libraries.
Oh, yeah.
They just detested it. I think it's because of the encroachment of government or the man or something. They just never wanted to fund public libraries. And to me, it's, you know, and this is obvious, this is a school library. This is not quite the same thing. But I mean, you know, libraries, I mean, that should be like item number one.
The more books, the better.
And this is a neighborhood. It's outer East Portland. And so it does not have the density of libraries that we have in inner city Portland. And so it's a bus ride for these kids to go to the library over the summer. And
I loved having books over the summer when I was a kid.
Yeah.
It was great.
Well, you know, and I'm not saying this because it's Lent. It's like a kid that you give books to now or like when he's like 5 or 10, that's a kid who's not going to be sticking you up with a sharpened screwdriver later on, you know, when you're 15 or 20. I mean, I think there's a direct correlation there between reading young and then, you know, and not just being like a misfit dirtbag when you're older.
And the idea is you give kids books they're actually going to read.
Right.
So you give them Dora books and you give them princess books and you give them SpongeBob graphic novels, and you give them stuff that they're going to be excited to have and share with their friends and read more than once. And they wound up collecting more than 10,000 books.
Really?
Enough for each kid to take 12 books home over the summer.
And what age kids are these?
These are elementary school kids.
See, that's fantastic.
And
then the
books were donated?
The books were donated.
Nice.
It was books that were donated, and it was people giving donations so that they could buy new books.
I mean, that is – and really, no fooling. I mean, that is one of the – that is really one of the – if people, you know, if people fixate on, like, what can I do to give my child an advantage? What can I do? You know, what music should I hold up at, like, against my womb while I'm pregnant so the kid will come out like a brainiac? I mean, it's like the earlier you teach your kid to read, I mean, all things being equal, the better off they're going to be and the more they read.
And there is a great nonprofit in Portland, the Children's Book Bank, that takes donations of books and cleans them up and puts them in little packages and takes them to schools and churches and community groups and gives them out to kids whose parents might not be able to take them to the library or might not be able to buy them books. It's a really – if you have books at home that you're looking to get rid of, which is always the situation in my house with my spoiled children. children. Or if you're looking like for a cause to give to, the Children's Book Bank is awesome. And they helped this elementary school. And it's just this, it's a really nice.
And is that citywide story. Or statewide? Or
the book bank is, I think they work in the region.
All right, I'm going to make a note of that. You know, I was actually just talking to somebody the other day about Dolly Parton, of all people, does this thing in her home. It's either in her home county or I don't think it's her actual hometown because I think she's from some like unincorporated like Appalachian
mountain. Yeah,
like from Lickskillet, West Virginia, or something. And so, but her home county, she actually helps to fund this program where I think if you are every kid who's born in her county receives a book a month for the first 3 years of their life. And so, the idea is by the time you're 3 years old, you've got 36 books that you own. At a minimum, you will own 36 books.
And you're in the habit of reading.
Exactly. And she pointed out, and if you get a book a month from the day you're born, you grow up with the idea of having books around, that they are a part of your environment, that they are a thing that's there. I mean, the one thing, however much I sometimes make fun of my family and their various shades of craziness, is that my family, my sister especially, put an emphasis on reading and a premium on being able to read and taught me to read, you know, as soon as she possibly could. Because, you know, that is the thing which you think is obvious to everybody, which you hope that everybody understands. But that is like the skeleton key to all other things in your life.
Many, many adults, you know, you finish high school or you finish college and you're done reading. Mm-hmm. And it has become this pastime for affluent people. And it's the unfortunate truth is, you know, poor kids are not going to have the same access to the books that are going to make them want to read. You know, they're not going to have Captain Underpants and Harry Potter. They're going to have whatever is in the school library, and school librarians don't have the money to buy a bunch of new books anymore.
Well, that's the other thing. And I got into a screaming argument at one point with a friend of mine. She was an English teacher. And we were having some huge debate because I was going on one of my sort of like tiresome screeds about how, in my opinion, that public schools did it all wrong, because the thing that public schools do is they try to instill this, quote, love of reading by just jamming kids full of crap that no one wants to read, that no one. I mean, I can count on zero fingers the number of adults I know who sit around and while away the hours by reading Shakespeare. It just doesn't, you know, that is not necessarily the way to get kids to appreciate reading as a thing you do for its own sake and without anybody around prodding you into doing it.
If I were a newspaper editor, I don't care how much money you lose, I would take 6 pages every day and just put comics in them.
Yeah.
You know, my son reads the newspaper every day. He's 8 years old and he reads the comics. And he started that a couple years ago, back in the days when newspapers did newspapers in education. And for like 6 weeks in the summer, every Sunday paper had a reproduction of an old Spider-Man comic book. And so he just got in the habit every Sunday he would go out and get the paper to find the Spider-Man. And he was like 5 at this point. And he couldn't read. He was just like the comic book.
That is fantastic.
And it just got him in the habit. And now you see him, you know, like every night at around 7 o'clock, he goes into the bathroom with the comics.
That's
like a middle-aged man, you know. So there were the newspaper at his feet.
With his Reader's Digest condensed book.
Exactly.
That's awesome. That's the, I mean, and that is, you know, it is, I think what instigated this argument with this friend of mine is I think I made the flip comment. I said that if you want kids to read in school, I said you know, Shakespeare, Schmakespeare. You know, I said why don't they just feel, you know, like, why? I think I made the observation that they should just have the kids reading like Stephen King or something. You know, something that kids gravitate to on their own.
Just read something.
Just read something as long as you are reading, because then it's like a priming the pump thing, and it becomes a self perpetuating activity. I mean, I've told the story probably until the tale has gone stale of visiting my grandparents who lived in Markham or Malala or something at the time. But my parents, I would just be brought along into my family in my family's horrible Econoline van for these dreadful trips to meet my parents, and which was a lot of like my grandmother being drunk in front of the TV and screaming at wrestling matches, and my grandfather, being out back splitting wood largely as a way to avoid my grandmother, and everybody else just sitting around in a sort of stuffy, awkward silence talking about Avon decanters. And it was just like hell. It was just hell on earth. But the other thing we would have to do is we would have to drive along. We would have to stop at every so-called antique store, which was really just a pile of junk that like a guy was selling in like an old chicken coop. And just, you know, it's just miserable. It's just the worst possible way. And I'm like 12 and it just sucks. And you're just sitting there hating your life. But I remember going to one of these junk stores and just, you know, where there's always and the thing about those junk stores is the item that they seem to have for sale more than anything else, they always just seem to have those big glass like flotation beads inside a fishnet that like I don't even know where they come from, especially Malala, but they're always just there, you know, and like back issues of like Chilton's Auto Manual or whatever. But I remember when I was just poking around in the book section, because that was the only thing that held in and appealed to me. and finding a copy of a book that I had never heard of and a movie that I didn't even know it was a movie, I don't think it's time, but finding a copy of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And it was a quarter. And I think I picked it up because on the front it was just a little it was the Signet version, and it just had this sort of the red-haired McMurphy in the straitjacket, and it looked kind of cool because there's a guy in a straitjacket, and I didn't, you know, and on the front it just said, you know, it had a blurb from Time. It said, you know, like engrossing or something, and I was like, well, I'll buy this, and I had no idea what it was, and it just like blew my mind. I mean, it just took my brain apart and polished it and put it back together, and I never would have just wandered in and picked that up and purchased it myself if I had not been blessed with a family and a sister who actually taught me to read and taught me to read for its own sake, not for a project, not for an assignment, not because I had to get a grade, not because there was some shrew-like nun who was threatening me into doing it. It was a thing I did because I wanted to do it. So anyway,
it's great that the Rick Emerson Show comes out in favor of reading.
I'm
in favor of books.
One would like to think that that's not such an outrageous position.
It's a controversial
Eric.
Stand, but.
What did Paul Revere do? I don't remember.
And then again, I don't know where Montana is, so it's like, you know, it's nature's way of distributing favors and knowledge, I guess. Well, let's do one more here. We'll take a brief break. We'll come back on the other side and wrap all this up. Eric D. Snyder, will you give us one more story before we end things for this segment?
I will. You want something light and funny or something?
Well, let's see. We have a I'm looking here. We have
Various watches. I gave
you I gave you some of the soundbite, the entertainment sound bites. Yes. Those three. Let's do one of those. I'll just let you select one of those at your leisure, and we'll do that. We'll break and come back on the other side.
Here's J.J. Abrams, director of Star Trek and producer of several hit TV shows, wrote and directed Super 8, a picture about a group of kids in 1979 Ohio who witness a mysterious train crash. Produced by Steven Spielberg, Super 8 is reminiscent of Spielberg's late 70s, early 80s work. Here, Abrams talks about Super 8 being produced under the Amblin Entertainment banner.
The film was never intended to be an homage to anything. It was just meant to be a movie about these characters, because that was the first thing that occurred to me. But as I started working on the story, it was clear that this felt like it could be a movie that would sort of live under the Amblin umbrella. And when Steven himself said, this should be an Amblin movie, like literally an Amblin movie, which I don't think an Amblin movie has ever had its title at the beginning of the film. You know, the idea of it being, you know, one of those movies was freeing, because suddenly I thought, oh, that's what this movie is. Like, it is small town America in that era with these people, you know, with the families, with this thing that was happening, otherworldly thing. All that stuff kind of felt like, you know, there's a little bit of a kind of pang of guilt you get when you sort of have kids jump on these BMX bikes and you're like, can you really have kids on bikes? It's like, well, if you're doing a movie in 79, what are they going to do? That's what they do. They're kids, of course, you know. And it reminded me of doing Star Trek, and I remember, you know, early on, I was like, can we really do like lasers in space and flying spaceships flying? It seems so cliche and silly. And it's like, it's Star Trek. It's like, yes, you can do that. That's when else are you going to ever do that? You know, and so for me, having, you know, being able to be, you know, another director who got to work on an Amblin movie, and there are a lot of them, it was kind of this freeing feeling of being able to sort of embrace that, those elements and those things that felt like they were naturally part of it.
Is it true that there hasn't been an Amblin film proper like for some years? That Spielberg quit putting things out under the Amblin banner or whatever?
I believe that is true.
I guess because that was just his production company, right? That was
right.
Just the sort of, so I guess maybe he just put them out as just, you know, like whatever, like straight Paramount films or
right, yeah, whoever, yeah.
And I know that it makes, and it's not, you were asking me earlier about something, I think, before the show, and I said that I was a bad geek.
Yes.
For, what was it,
you
why was
seen,
I a bad
You
geek?
Haven't seen Hobo with a Shotgun.
Because I haven't seen Hobo with a Shotgun, and so I was saying I'm a bad geek. And also, it's not that, I don't know, I feel like I'm missing some sort of gene, or I'm just, it's like people who can't see the color green or something, because I'm, like, all the Super 8 stuff is just sort of, it's not that it looks bad, I'm just sort of, I am left sort of cold by the whole thing. I just, I'm kind of indifferent, I think, to Super 8 at this moment, and maybe it ends up being fantastic, but, you know, I just, I'm sort of nonplussed by the whole thing.
There was an interesting profile of J.J. Abrams in the New York Times Magazine a couple weeks ago, where it talked about sort of his storytelling philosophy and the excuse me, the sense that there should be like the magic box,
right.
I think was the phrase, in the middle
box.
Of everything. And
is that the unknown, the mysterious, the MacGuffin?
What's in the hatch and yeah. all that stuff?
I want to know what's in the box at the end of a story. And I just find, I don't know, I'm still sad about the end of Lost.
Well, but that's my thing. Is like that was my whole thing when the Blair Witch Project came out, and I remember saying, like, at some point you got to show me the shark, you know? Like, you just have to. I mean, it's like that.
You know, there's no shark in Blair Witch, right?
Damn!
I think there's your problem.
Damn you!
There's your problem.
But I think, and I think that is part of it. Is like I am such a, you know, it's not, you know, it's not that I can't appreciate the fantastical and the sort of mysterious, and I also appreciate suspense. But at the end, I want to feel like it's leading me somewhere. I think that is part of my binary nature, is that I want an actual, I want a payoff, you know.
I don't know about you, but I am also a little bit tired of the, there's a twist, there's a mystery, there's an unanswered question. Because at this point, how many times have you seen that story?
Well, that's the other thing about Super 8, is it just feels like, and I know there's only so many ways to tell the same kind of tale, but it does feel like all of, like a sort of greatest hits of Steven Spielberg and J.J. Abrams rolled into one. And you, Eric, you would probably know more about this than I do, because I haven't seen, I mean, you're probably tracking it closer than I am, but I, you know.
I've actually been trying to avoid hearing too much about it, and I haven't seen it yet. But I don't get the sense that there will be unanswered questions, there's mysteries or whatever about it. But I agree that it's kind of vague about what it is. I think if there weren't the Steven Spielberg connection to it, I don't think it would have much attention at all.
I mean, maybe that's just a thing they do for the marketing. I mean, maybe
it just feels very Cloverfield to me.
That's
like, oh, it's a monster movie. Yeah, I've seen that.
You know, and so that's I say all this, but at the same time, it's like J.J. Abrams makes great. He makes great stuff. He really does.
Where is my next Star Trek movie? Bring it now, please.
So yeah, I feel like I'm in no real position to criticize him. I guess it has to do with the marketing and the positioning of it.
Yeah.
You know, more than the actual film itself. Which again,
he says Star Trek is next.
Well, which and.
So he's getting right on it.
You know, and with the ending of Lost notwithstanding, I mean, that's a guy who
which he had nothing to do with.
And
anyway.
It's probably unfair to hang that on him.
Yeah.
Because the worst that you can probably say about J.J. Abrams is that he does kind of what Whedon does too, which is where he eventually neglects his children because he's got something new and bright and shiny that he's paying attention to, where Alias kind of goes in the tank after, you know, third or fourth season because he's preoccupied with whatever. So, you know, that's probably the.
They're not going back and remaking them with Jar Jar Binks, it's all fun.
No, probably not. Let's do one more. Let's do the John Carpenter thing, if you've got that, because I've got that right here.
Oh, yeah. Here it is. John Carpenter returns with The Ward, his first feature-length film since his 2001 box office misfire, Ghosts of Mars. The Ward centers on an institutionalized woman who, along with several other inmates, is being terrorized by what appears to be a ghost. Carpenter discussed the challenges he faced with The Ward.
Is someone's phone vibrating?
I hear that, but it's...
Is that my phone?
It's
mine.
Okay. All right. I was just going to be filled with shame there for a second.
I couldn't hear the buzzing. I thought it was my own head.
You have this labeled Chandler 01, even though it's Carpenter.
I'm sorry. That's my fault. Okay, big failure. All right,
we barely had any money for the makeup and hair. Well, we had a lot of struggles on this film because it was a tiny movie.
Of women.
A lot of very beautiful and talented actresses. And there's nothing better than being in an asylum.
John Carpenter sounds drunk.
You have a bunch of crazy people in an asylum. They're all beautiful Hollywood actresses. It's awesome. No, it's all about storytelling. Okay, that's all it's directing is about. It's not about equipment. It's not about anything else. It's telling the story.
It does sound drunk.
No one would give me any money because Ghosts of Mars sucked. So we didn't have a lot for makeup.
I can't believe it's been 10 years since his last movie.
Oh, man. I remember about seeing Ghosts of Mars. I remember sitting in the theater and, first of all, just feeling like a chump, just realizing that I was a mark because I had actually paid for it. I remember sitting in the theater and realizing sometimes you have this experience where you're watching the movie and even as you're watching it, you are realizing that another part of your brain is preparing to erase it from your memory as soon as you're done. You know what I mean? It's like one of those self-destructing messages from Mission Impossible. Where you're like, yeah, I'm going to be leaving the theater, and in 5 minutes, I won't even remember that I was here.
It's like we can already see the street sweeper coming in after the parade.
Exactly. That's I remember so little about that except just I had an undying sense of regret having given
that's
him.
Even, you know, it's one thing to go see a bad movie that's worth talking about afterwards, but that's one of the ones that.
It left no impression on me whatsoever. I mean, which is, and then I feel, and the thing, but the thing about John Carpenter is, John Carpenter is like Toby Hooper in that I always want, like, whatever his new film is, you know, to be great. And it's, you know, it's like that way with certain musical artists too, where you get to the point where you know, you know, you realize, like, you know, that probably, you know, like whatever Roger Whittaker is putting out this month, it's probably not going to be gold, no matter how much I root for it to be. And then, you know, and you're constantly disappointed, but you constantly give them another chance, and then they constantly let you down again because you remember that one time you saw that thing that they did that one year that was really, really good.
Pop culture abusive relationships.
Exactly. That's totally what it is. I actually sort of lied. We might as well just, because we're going to close this out here in about 10 minutes, so we might as well just stick around unless somebody really needs to
take a picture of their private parts.
Exactly. I'm just looking for a different.
If you know what I mean.
Somebody asked when the piece about the Children's Book Bank is coming. When that will be?
Friday's Oregonian.
Excellent. It'll be in the Oregonian, and you can read that at OregonLive.com. As well. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. I'll take just a moment here to say that today's program, like Legion News, it's and the other, whatever I was going with there. Let me just stop. Okay. Today's program, not unlike Legion of News and all other fine things on planet Earth, brought to you in part by Squires Electric. You can find out more about them at squireselectric.com. You can call 503-252-1609, or you can go to facebook.com/Squires Electric. They are licensed, bonded, and insured electrical installers, contractors, and supervisors. And they can make your life easier, whether it's your home, whether it's your home business, or whether it's it has to do with upgrading, installing, repairing, whether somebody's going to be renting you their place, you're going to be renting your place or selling your home to somebody else. You want to make sure that everything works. Everything is above board. If you are working in a business where you got to get an inspection done, you want to make sure ahead of time that you're going to pass the inspection, have Squires Electric come on out and just look at the whole joint top to bottom and make sure that you're going to get through the first time. SquiresElectric.com is the website, or Facebook.com/SquiresElectric. You can also call 503-252-1609. That's 503-252-1609, SquiresElectric.com. If it has to do with wires or wiring in your home or business, they can make your life easier. They are Squires Electric. We are here with Anna Griffin from the Oregonian, also Mr. Eric D. Snyder, who is in for Don Taylor. Let's see. In addition to the comment just now about the Oregonian, somebody is asking what is coming up this Friday on the Movie BS with Baron Snyder.
We'll be talking about Super 8.
So, well, one of you, are you going to see it before then?
I've seen it, yeah. I've seen it by then. Jeff has already seen it. Jeff went on the junket, like he interviewed Kyle Chandler and
really?
Somebody.
Yeah. Kyle Chandler, he's the Friday Night Lights guy,
right? Yeah.
So, and he's a guy that I'm a big fan of his.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a fan of sort of everybody involved in this.
Right.
But again, I think it's like a reflexive reaction to the fact that it does seem to contain. And it's not like Steven Spielberg films are themselves all like fresh new reinventions of something. I mean, it's, you know, he has a limited number of moving parts, I think. you know, he just puts them together really, really, really well most of the time.
Like Taco Bell, you got a finite number of ingredients. It's different combinations of them.
Exactly.
It's exactly like
And then
Taco
the rest
Bell.
Of it is like a filler bag of daddy issues that you just pour into the...
Red sent me today that Sheila Buff says another Indiana Jones movie is coming.
Hooray.
Yeah. No.
Here's the thing about that is it's like a defensive mechanism. About halfway through Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, I was mentioning the Ghost of Mars thing and how I realized that I was going to... I realized about halfway through the last indie film that there was sort of like a mental blast shield going down inside my brain that was actually just protecting me from caring about that movie anymore.
Was Karen Allen in it? Because in my mind,
oh, yeah,
she was.
Yeah.
She was.
But that's all I remember.
Yeah.
She was.
No, I think about...
That was the high point of the movie. Like, about, oh, Karen Allen, look.
I think about the moment he was swinging from vines to the forest, it was like just as, you know, it was. I felt like some sort of a Sybil where I was splitting into Rick before and Rick after, you know, and Rick after, who was seeing the film, was sort of ensconced in his own sort of bubble away from Rick before, who loved all of the Indiana Jones movies.
It was not like a Phantom Menace moment where you look up and go, they've ruined this for me, but it was one of the, I am just going to pretend I did not see this.
It was just going into my own little happy place, mm-hmm. really. That's what it was.
You guys need to know this. Anne Hathaway pistol whipped a stuntman.
Really? Wait, hold on. Where's my breaking news? Hold on a second.
Actress Anne Hathaway injured a stuntman on the set of the Batman film The Dark Knight Rises, reports the British tabloid The Sun. Says a source, Anne got a bit carried away during a fight scene and mistakenly shoved the butt of a gun right into the actor's eye socket. He came away with a massive black eye. Anne was mortified. It was all in good humor, but the poor guy took quite a pummeling.
The number of people who can say they've been pistol whipped by Anne Hathaway seems to be necessarily finite. So, I mean, that guy at least has a story
exactly,
to tell.
Exactly, yeah. Anne Hathaway whacked me in the eye socket with the butt of a gun.
Is it wrong or weird that I find that kind of hot?
No, it is kind of hot. No, it's... and I would, in fact, I would eschew kinda in that sentence. No, you're really... You are correct about that. Well done. Well, excellent.
I felt like you needed to know that right away.
Do we have a taser watch?
We do have a taser
Let's
watch.
Let's do that, and then I will prepare the... I'm actually printing the snuff watch out for you here. So, okay. While I'm getting that done... Wait, where's the... Wait for it. There we go. Here's your taser watch for Wednesday. Here is your taser watch for Wednesday. Here's Mr. Eric D. Snyder.
Armed police shot a man with a taser stun gun today, yesterday that is, after he walked into a branch of department store John Lewis, this is in England, and stabbed himself several times in the stomach.
This is the second, now, this is just like a story we had yesterday that was, I think, from the day before, which would have been Monday, about a woman who was fired from a hardware store, and then she came back and started stabbing herself, like in the middle of the store itself. So
huh.
Some
yeah,
sort
this
of
a
rash of these things, okay.
Yeah, this was in Watford, Hertfordshire, in England. Jolly old England. A man walks into the department store and starts stabbing himself in the stomach. Eyewitnesses said the man entered the furniture department, armed with a knife, and plunged it into his stomach repeatedly in front of frightened shoppers and staff. Police raced to the scene and were forced to deploy a taser to bring the man under control.
Anything? Well, first of all, that seems like a problem that would have just sorted itself out if you'd just given it another 30
like
or 40 seconds.
That is a self-correcting
mess. The
yeah.
mess, Rick.
I mean,
somebody
I suppose.
Has to clean that up.
I guess. It just, I mean, yeah, it seems like that's a circle that closes itself after not too long.
So the British bobbies showed up. And did all their all? Oh, what's this then?
Are they allowed to? Are they allowed to carry stun guns?
Yeah, this is like a Benny Hill skit.
What's all this then?
Did they do it like they ran around like a real jittery, like you know, while Yakety Sax playing underneath?
Yep.
Are they allowed to carry stun guns? Because I guess they must be because they're not allowed to carry like regular guns, right?
Right. Although this says armed police. Although maybe they're counting the taser as being armed.
Or maybe there's like a subsection of the police. Maybe there's a subset
what do you think
of police.
They call
that
them the tasers. They've got to have some fun name, right?
Sparky Boys?
No, here's a quote from a police spokesman.
Jibbity lads.
We were called in just before 1 p.m. today to the John Lewis department store.
Wow.
Following reports of a man with a knife. Officers deployed a taser for the man's own safety, and he was taken to hospital with multiple injuries.
When you said there was a quote, I was thinking to myself, God, I hope he does an accent.
By the way, okay, can I just say this, just a follow-up to that? Okay, so I revealed yesterday that I'm reading the Keith Richards biography right now, his autobiography, which is awesome. But I mean, it's huge though. I mean, it's massive, and so but I'm doing this thing that I do every now and again. I had a free book coming from Audible, and so I downloaded the unabridged audiobook of the Keith Richards autobiography as well because it's because that way when I'm driving, I can be sort of multi.
But
you know,
is he reading
because
it?
You wanted Jack Sparrow to read something to you.
Okay, but that's the thing. So it's like I'm reading it at home, and then when I'm in the car, if I have like if I'm driving to Beaverton or something, where it's like an hour of just sitting there, and so I've got the unabridged so I can actually be reading it, even when I'm not at home. And I did not know. Okay, so it's Johnny Depp, which first of all, I made the observation yesterday that it's like it was like the universe wanted me to be absolutely certain that he was the greatest man on earth. Like in case I wasn't sure that Johnny Depp was in fact the greatest human being alive. Just to make sure that I knew my place in the order of things. It's like, well, he's not only Johnny Depp, he's not only like the best looking guy like ever in the history of good looking guys. He's not only the best actor of your generation. He not only like plays guitar with Oasis occasionally. Also, he's Jack Sparrow, which is kind of like being Keith Richards. But in case he hadn't just sealed off that, like he's actually now going to be Keith Richards for the purposes of reading his autobiography. So I'm in the drive-thru yesterday as I'm leaving the drive-thru of the Wendy's, and I've been listening to this, and I'm only in like chapter 3 or 4. It's like very early on. But my iPhone does this thing occasionally. My iPhone has this symptomology where if I drop it or if I bump it really hard, for some reason, that always results in the shuffle button being activated. And I don't know why that is because it's not a physical button. It's just a touch button on the screen. So I don't know why that is. But if I ever jostle or bump or whatever, I'll hear this boop, and then the shuffle goes on and then it skips to like, some other place in the album. So I'm like 3 chapters in, and Don had asked, like, well, is he making like a funny accent for Keith Richards? Is he, and I'm like, no, he's just, he's just speaking basically in his Johnny Depp voice, but he sometimes augments the accent, like for a relative or a friend or whatever. And so I'm only at like chapter three. I hit the shuffle button. I can't believe I didn't say this. I hit the shuffle button by accident. It skips to like chapter 75, which is like, you know, in 1982. And it's like, it's suddenly, because he talks, for the part where I'm at it right now, he's just talking in his normal Johnny Depp voice, kind of like this. I skip ahead to like 1972 or whatever in the book, and suddenly he's talking like this. And I don't know if I had it on the wrong speed somehow, or if it was just one of those things, like just to demonstrate again that he's like the most talented guy who ever lived, if he is doing something of slowly augmenting his voice and adjusting it over the course of the book. So by the time he gets to like, in conclusion, he's like going to be the Keith Richards as we know
Keith
now.
Richards, yeah, he's taken over Keith Richards. Oh, by the way, so there is there's a control on your iPod that you have to go and adjust, because there's a setting that if you shake it, it shuffles.
Why would you want that feature? Why would I ever want that?
I have no idea.
That would be like a thing, like if I shake it and it just electrocutes me or something.
It's one of those too cute for its own good.
Okay, that must be why that happens, because I knock it, and it's always when I'm reading something where I don't want to know the outcome, you know, and it goes to the, you know, to the end. Yeah. So, but I skip ahead, and I swear to God, he was talking in a totally different, much lower voice, and I don't know. And I don't even know if I listen all the way through, if I'll notice it, because it sounds like it might be a gradual transition.
Very purposeful. It's just an acting decision he made.
You know, it's one of those things where it's like, he really is lucky that he is so talented. Or I would, you know, I think he would just be loathed by everybody for stuff like that. Exactly. This is your Taser Watch. While I close this out, I'm going to hand you the snuff watch for today. We'll do that, and then we will bring the curtain down on this juvenile exercise. Thank you. By the way, four different people have said, that's the worst accent I've ever heard, Eric D. Snyder.
Thank you.
So do you make Dick Van Dyke sound like Laurence Olivier in Mary Poppins.
Don't taste me, bro.
Well done. All right, well, let's just do this back to back. That was your Taser Watch. As we get ready to close the show out for Wednesday, here is your Snuff Watch for Wednesday. Here is Mr. Eric D. Snyder in for Don Taylor.
Andrew Gold, a pop wunderkind who had barely finished high school when Linda Ronstadt enlisted him to play in her backup band, and who later had a successful recording career of his own with hits like Lonely Boy and Thank You for Being a Friend, died on Friday at his home in Encino, California. He was 59. His family said that he had renal cancer. What is that? Liver, kidneys?
I believe that is your
kidneys.
Bladder?
Renal.
Your whole, yes, your, yes.
Yeah. It's some kind of cancer, the kind that kills you.
And it's the bad kind of
the
cancer.
The bad kind. Yes. Been responding well to treatment, but that the cause of death might have been a heart attack. Oh, twist ending. I wish a train would go by.
I think we're doing the show from inside a Johnny Cash song all of a sudden.
Mr. Gold's combination of instrumental versatility and songwriting skill gave me a prominent, if sometimes invisible, role. You can't have a role that is prominent and invisible.
No, I don't think that's actually possible. Here's the thing. It's not that I – sometimes, like, you'll hear that where the guy dies and you go, like, I swear to God, I thought he was already dead.
Yeah.
Bob Barker.
For example, yeah.
It's not even that I thought he was dead. It's just like I had completely forgotten – Like he was no longer
worse than being dead, really.
Right.
You completely forgot he ever lived.
Like, if I had to list people on Earth at this moment, I don't think you could have, like, I could have had an infinite number of monkeys just typing out the names of people I thought were alive on an infinite number of typewriters, and his name never would have come up. Like, I just, like, he's a guy who just, like, he came, he wrote the songs, and then he just vanished from, like, the cultural consciousness, like, altogether.
He had Thank You for Being a Friend, which, of course, later was better known as the Golden Girls theme.
Which he did not perform for the Golden Girls, though.
Right.
There was, like, some unknown, like, some studio guy who sang
but
that.
He had written that
song.
He got a nickel every time that show came on, I'll bet.
There was that, and then he did Lonely Boy.
Lonely Boy. He was a much sought-after musician whose guitar and piano work, and he also played bass and drums. He was on recordings by James Taylor, Carly Simon, Maria Muldaur, Jackson Browne, Loudon Wainwright III. He never learned how to read music, though he was a master musician. You know who his mother was? Marnie Nixon, best known for dubbing the singing voices of Natalie Wood in West Side Story and Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady. That was his mother. She's still alive. There's a quote from her.
And his dad was somebody as well. His dad was
Ernest Gold, who wrote the Academy Award winning score for the movie Exodus, as well as the scores for Judgment
That's
Nuremberg
who it was.
And Ship of Fools.
That's who it was because the great them always said that Lonely Boy was secretly about his dad. Mm. That was the thing because it was like he always felt overshadowed by his dad, right, having like scored all these great films. And
yeah, both of his parents were musically talented.
Excellent. So.
And yeah, now he's dead.
The end. There you go. There's
so
your
much for that guy.
There's your snuff watch for Wednesday here on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. If somebody wants to hear more from the comedic stylings of Mr. Eric D. Snyder, you can be heard Fridays 11 a.m. to noon at Cascadia.fm, part of Movie BS with Baron Snyder, also redditfilm.com and at ericdsnyder.com. And Anna Griffin, the story about the Children's Book Bank coming up Friday.
Friday's Oregonian.
Reader and print in the Oregonian, online at OregonLive.com. And so we will probably have a couple more visits with you before you...
You're not done with me yet.
Well, I'm not trying to hustle you out the door or something. I'm just saying...
I have to come give you geography lessons, iPhone lessons.
You should call in from Mount Rushmore.
You know I should.
I just want to be prepared.
You'll just hear
so this
screaming from the Subaru.
I just want to be. I want to be prepared. This is one of those. We don't flash forward to a day where Don and I are just sitting here going, "No, she'll be here any second." And then we're just looking at the door. And it seems to me that there was some television show that ended that way, and I can't think of what it was, but where we're just sort of looking at the door, waiting for a guest who will never arrive. So, in any event, Eric, thank you for sitting in for Don Taylor. And,
the pleasure was entirely mine.
Anna Griffin, as we often say, thank you for tolerating our juvenile inanity and seemingly relentless penis discussion.
I feel very at home here.
Yeah, excellent. The Rick Emerson Radio Program comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the Milk Packing District in glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, Eric D. Snyder, Advanced Technology and Magic, provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, Executive Producer Bruce Agler, Chief of Staff at Cheryl Kanakoa. After a brief musical interlude, we'll have an encore of the day's Legion of News, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program. It is Wednesday, June 8th, 2011, and that is The Frequency. Kenneth, as always, thank you for listening. Be safe. See you all tomorrow. Bye now.